Blog Talk Radio.
Call is now being recorded.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Monday Rundown here on the Leatherheads National Podcasting Network, sponsored by ITWAN. If you're a business that needs affordable IT support, ITWAN is who you need to call. For business quality IT support nationwide, you can call ITWAN at 781-462-1380. They can do remote IT services as well as cloud and all those kinds of things. So, again, if you need IT support, give ITWAN a call at 781-462-1380. I'm your host, Chris Mitchell, and with me every single week is Brandon Williams. This week, week 17, a lot of NFL games, not all that meaningful, but a lot of that doesn't mean a lot of things aren't going on. Week 17 was a big-time week, a lot going on. We're actually in the process of Black Monday, which means coaches are being chopped off left and right over here. We'll talk a lot about that. We'll talk about AP and the MVP. We'll talk about Rookie of the Year a little bit in recognition of yesterday's games and how guys like Andrew Luck and RG3 and Alfred Morris played into what meaningful games there were yesterday. Obviously, we'll talk a lot about the coaches, all the firings, the potential firings, the ones guys that look like they saved their jobs. We'll talk about the Houston Texans. We got to talk about them. Their late season collapse really put themselves in a tough bind going into the playoffs. Of course, they did make it, but they really hurt their chance. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the draft order a little bit towards the end of the show as well. And then, of course, we have to talk about the playoff picture, and we'll get into next week's game. Those are all on tap for tonight. But with me every single week, Brandon Williams. Brandon, how's everything going there down south? And you're close to Houston now. And Dallas, two teams that really were probably the biggest losers, because the Giants didn't make the playoffs and neither did the Bears, but Dallas not making the playoffs and Houston falling from the one seed to the three. What's the talk down there? There must be a lot of drinking and a lot of depression going on.
It seems appropriate that, you know, on the day after two big disasters involving the two Texas teams, that both cities are, you know, overcast and gloomy. You know, and I'm right outside the Houston area, maybe 20 miles south of it. But, you know, obviously in Houston, the big question is, you know, the late season collapse. You know, where do you put the finger at? You know, a lot of people are focusing on the fact that, you know, Gary Kubiak and Rick Dennison's play calling has been, you know, very simplistic. You know, you also have to consider the fact that, you know, the injuries starting to pile up, particularly at linebacker. And in Dallas, you know, I mean, obviously the big question there is, you know, where do you go from here? You know, you had a golden opportunity to step up and earn a playoff spot. And I think a lot of people thought that had the Cowboys won last night, that they probably would have been an interesting X factor going into the postseason. But now, you know, you have to wonder about, you know, the future of this franchise. You know, there's a lot of talent there, but for some reason, it's just not jelly. And I think that Jerry Jones is going to have to make some major overhauls during the offseason in order to get this team to a position to compete in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, and I've talked about this ever since really we started the show, because I like to be critical. I'm from Boston, and we're critical people up here. Some people would call it pessimistic. I like to call it critical. And I've been critical of Jason Garrett. I don't believe he's a good head coach. I have no doubt that he's a great NFL mind or an offensive mind or the X's and O's. I don't even know well enough to really be able to even criticize anyone for that necessarily. But I just don't think he's a good head coach, and I think they're disappointing, and I think they've underperformed. And George and I tweeted back and forth about this issue a little bit last night, and I do want to get into what George and I were discussing. But one thing that I kind of contradicts what I'm saying here is, I heard Trent Dilfer say it last night, and I found this very interesting. I like Trent Dilfer on ESPN. He's one of the few guys on ESPN I actually like, because he seems to be fair and reasonable rather than hyped one way or hyped the other, which is kind of drives me crazy in the media. But one thing I found interesting was, if you want Jason Garrett fired, which of course is a natural thing to talk about, but he also said, if you want Tony Romo gone, because again, he's won one important game in like 10, he's like 1-8 or 1-9 in the playoffs or in games that could have got them into the playoffs. So essentially he has choked. Now, does he deserve the blame or not? That's sort of what George and I were talking about, and we'll get into that. But he said, if you want Romo gone, I found it interesting that he even mentioned that Romo needed to be addressed, whether he should be gone or not, because he has a lot of talent, and he has some big games, but yes, he doesn't seem to be a guy that can get it done. So I found it interesting, A, that he mentioned Romo at all, because, of course, Jason Garrett is natural to mention him. But to mention Romo I thought was interesting just because he was mentioned. But the point that he made that was more interesting was, if you are to get rid of Garrett, and you are to get rid of Romo, which is a much more difficult thing, who could replace Romo? And really, as we saw this year in the NFL, if you don't have at least a good quarterback, you just can't survive. I mean, Arizona, the Jets, the Bills to some extent. I mean, these teams were in Jacksonville and in Minnesota, we thought. That's one of the things that's so amazing about Adrian Peterson this year was Christian Ponder really had a good portion of his season, he was terrible. So you have a really bad quarterback, and you really can't even compete. So if there are people out there that think Romo's a choker and all these different things, A, maybe we should look at it a little bit more closely and give him some blame, but not all the blame. But B, who are you going to bring in instead? I mean, there's just nobody to bring in. So I found that interesting. And B, when you talk about Jason Garrett, if you're going to get rid of him, who goes there? Do you bring him in a retread? Do you bring in a college guy? And who – there are some interesting guys out there, and I'm wondering – the one thing that I thought was the perfect fit and could have possibly saved all of Dallas' problems was Sean Payton. And we hear, Saturday or maybe even Sunday, Sean Payton officially now has signed with the Saints. So he's not an option. What do you think about Dilfer's point? I assume you agree that getting rid of Romo isn't really an option. But if you were to get rid of Garrett, is there someone out there or a couple guys out there that you think would truly make an impact and make this Dallas team play up to the level that we think they should be playing? Who would be the perfect fit for you now that Peyton's not on the table?
The big problem with the Cowboys trying to find coaches is, Jerry Jones has to look in the mirror. Jerry Jones has complete control of that franchise. He handles the personnel decisions. He's the final say in the draft, which means that, experienced coaches that have won Super Bowls since Jerry last won his back in the 95 season, guys like John Gruden, Bill Cowher, Tony Dungy, those are guys that I think can come in and make an impact, especially Gruden. But those guys are not going to want an owner/GM basically dictating what they can and cannot do. And I think that really hamstrings the Cowboys as far as their being able to grab a quality head coach. That means that Jason Garrett is going to stay. Because exactly, where are you going to go? Are you going to try to, it's not like you could go and grab Chip Kelly from Oregon. Obviously a name you're going to hear a lot, on this show, and especially as, more firings come along. You're not going to get a guy like a Chip Kelly. You're not going to get a quality head coach, which means that, you're stuck with Garrett. Now, as for Romo, no, you don't get rid of Tony Romo. Yeah, Cowboy fans, I know you're angry. I know you're hacked off that, yes, once again, Romo blew a game. So what else is new? But who else are you going to go out and get? Are you going to go out and try to get Alex Smith? Try to trade for, a TJ Yates? Tony Romo, for all of his faults, remains a good second-tier quarterback in the National Football League. He's not that top tier, obviously, with guys like Manning, Breeze, Rodgers, Brady, and the like. He's not out there, but he is a very solid number two guy. And that tells you that, the guy puts up good numbers, but obviously he falters in big games. And you have to wonder what direction the Cowboys will go in the offseason. Do you give him another chance? Obviously you will. But do you try to tweak things to maybe grab a quarterback in the draft with the belief that, if Romo falters next season and you really have to tear the whole place down, that you've got a kid in place? I don't know. And I think, if you look at some of the storylines that will go into the offseason, I think that situation in Dallas is going to be right up there because Jerry Jones is very unpredictable. And just because we haven't heard much about him now so far this morning does not mean that Jerry Jones will not do something drastic between now and training camp that will change the culture of this franchise, because I honestly think that that's what needs to happen. Unfortunately, you can't fire the owner, and I think that's really the big problem. know, you can compare this to Daniel Snyder in Washington. Daniel Snyder and the Redskins started getting better the second he stopped meddling in the team's affairs. And you can see where this Redskins franchise is going to go. Jerry Jones hasn't got that message yet. One playoff win in the last 16 years, and yet still he remains, you know, the be-all, end-all as far as personnel decisions. And until that time that Jerry Jones looks in the mirror and decides, you know what, I need to let the reins go and let competent NFL GMs and get a competent GM and a head coach that I know will command authority and get this team to the next level. Until those two things happen, the Cowboys are going to be stuck in that 9-7, either on the verge of making the playoffs or just out the playoffs limbo for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and you make two really interesting points, and it actually segues perfectly into my discussion with George Kurtz, who's a friend of the show and who does the fantasy show with us here on Leatherhead Podcasting Network. One is Jerry Jones and the way that he gets in the way. I see it this way. In the NFL, I almost think, and maybe I'm overseeing a little bit, but I almost think whether you can win the Super Bowl or not is 80% about the quarterback. And I say that because if you look at this year, some teams were so bad at quarterback that they just couldn't compete. They couldn't overcome anything. I look at the Jets, and we'll get into the firing of coaches and GMs and so forth. But one of the things that I give Rex Ryan credit for is I actually think he's a good coach. He's a very good defensive coach, and he plays that fundamental running first kind of style offense where I actually think he's a good enough coach that if you give him a decent quarterback, I don't think he'll win the Super Bowl, but I think he's good enough to make you competitive every single year. But as far as winning the Super Bowl, A, you need the quarterback, and then if you don't have the quarterback, only the most elite of elite coaches, I think, can actually win without it. And I think that's one of the reasons why Bill Parcells deserves a lot of credit, though granted, the quarterback wasn't as crucial, and he had Lawrence Taylor, so he had those kind of benefits going with him. But he did get to the Super Bowl with Drew Bledsoe, and I give Belichick credit. He won a Super Bowl with Tom Brady when Tom Brady wasn't what Tom Brady is now. I mean, when they won the Super Bowl over the Rams, A, they were significantly the underdog there. They should have been blown out, and instead they ended up winning that game. That alone kind of goes to the brilliance of Belichick and his staff. But Tom Brady was, at best, a game manager. He didn't make mistakes, and that is kind of what's so great about Brady now. But Brady didn't make plays either. He just managed the team and didn't lose the game. Bill Belichick deserves a ton of credit for at least that Super Bowl over the Rams. Now, you could almost say now Belichick could probably go on vacation and Brady would still possibly win a Super Bowl. So I think that's where the quarterback comes into play. But if you're going to win a Super Bowl without a great quarterback, you really need one of those very few, rare, elite coaches. And a guy like a Tony Dungy or maybe a Cowher, because he did pretty well with some mediocre quarterbacks, so maybe he is an elite guy. But you look at even a Dungy, or you look at even a Peyton, or these guys, I don't think that even those guys are necessarily good enough to win without a great quarterback. That's how important the situation is. But so that Romo seems like he should be good enough, and that's why I think maybe Garrett isn't good enough. But the point you raised, and this kind of gets to what I talked to George last night on Twitter, was he talked about how the Dallas Cowboys don't have any depth. And I said, and the whole discussion started because I said, Dallas has way too much talent to be fighting to get to 9-7 or to be fighting to get to 10-6 and be in the playoffs. It just seems like there's way too much talent for them to not be able to easily get to 10 wins. You know, easily. I mean, they single-handedly lost some games this year, for example. And George's point was that, yes, they have some stars. You can't get away from that. Dez Bryant, DeMarcus Ware, Sean Lee, who's injured but still a pretty good up-and-coming linebacker. Romo, Miles Austin, Jason Witten, DeMarco Murray is a very good running back. There's a lot of talent on that team. But his argument was, once you get away from the stars, all of a sudden everyone else is not only just mediocre, they're actually outright bad. Now, I can't honestly say that I know if Dallas's linemen on both sides of the ball and their safeties, I don't know if their guys are par or on par with the league or if they're below average or if they're outright dismal. I can't say that I know enough to really make that case one way or the other. But when George was saying that, to me, that's almost a Monday morning quarterbacking the situation. To me, that's the excuse for players not performing, is that they're just really bad. They're just not good enough. I mean, let me ask you this. The Cowboys role players, the guys that aren't the stars, are they truly a top-heavy and then everyone else is really bottom-barrel type of organization? They have 10 or 15 elite guys and then 35 to 38, not just average, not even just below, slightly below. Are they truly horrible? Or is that the excuse that people who try to defend Dallas make for the fact that they don't perform at the levels they're supposed to? Which side of that do you think they've fallen? Because when I hear people saying that, to me, that sounds more like an excuse than a reality. I mean, if you're a blue-collar bucket pail kind of guy, how much different can the good guy be versus the average guy versus the terrible guy? I mean, why can't Dallas go out and get a minimum wage safety and still be okay? I mean, I guess address George's point. Do you think that their depth is really well below average and that's why they lose? Or do you think they're average but playing at a disappointing level?
I think if you look at their offensive line, they're about league average. You know, they've got some young talent there, but it's not quite there yet. Now, defensively on their front line, you know, they have Jason Hatch, who I think is still an above average lineman. But if you look at their ends, they really weren't getting a lot of production from there. You know, as far as rushing the passer, everything was just pretty much DeMarcus Ware. And you really can't rely as good as Ware is, as great as he is, I should say. You really can't rely on that one guy. And I think George does make a good point that, you know, once you get past the names that we're all familiar with, especially at the skill positions, and you look at Ware, you look at Jason, Sean Lee, you look at Morris Claiborne, who I think is going to be an outstanding quarterback, you know, maybe Brandon Carr to an extent. Once you get past those guys, yeah, you've got a lot of ordinary league average or below average guys. Now, every team in the NFL is going to have those. And I think the big question is A, you know, how do you manage that depth? And B, can you find a coach that is able to maximize that talent? And I think when you talk about your doubts about Garrett, I think that's probably where one of his biggest faults is that he struggles in maximizing the depth and the talent of that team. Yes, you've got superstars. Yes, you've got Pro Bowlers, you know, all across the board. But it's those guys. And if you look at teams in the playoffs, it's those unknown guys that make the difference in winning ball games. Now, and you look at, I guess a team that you would probably look at, Denver, for example. You know, Peyton Manning is obviously the big name, but, Eric Decker is a guy that, really isn't a household name, but he's a big factor in that team getting to the playoffs. And I think you have to have those guys. And with the Cowboys, I think that there are maybe a couple of guys that are there, but right now they're just not being maximized. And I think that's the challenge that Jason Garrett faces.
Yeah, I mean, granted, drafting matters, and that's where Jerry Jones is a problem. Maybe because he plays such a role in the drafting, maybe they're not drafting those players where they can perform at the NFL level. And that could be part of it, and that's, I guess, part of the overall discussion. But I guess I still don't know, because they were a perfect example of the Patriots yesterday. Rob Ninkovich, he's a defensive lineman for the Patriots. He's had, I think, over 8 or 9 sacks for 2 seasons in a row now. He started as a special teamer. And he played so well on special teams that even though they didn't think he could be a lineman or a linebacker or a defensive end because they move him around a little bit, they didn't think he could really do that on a regular basis in the Patriots defense. And the Patriots defense isn't great, so that tells you how little they thought of him as a defensive player. But he was such a good special teamer that they figured he earned a spot to at least get some snaps and see if maybe you give him some snaps and all of a sudden he earns more time and so forth. Eventually, he earned a full-time defensive spot, and he now is between an 8 and 11 sack guy every single year. So that was a guy that they didn't know what they had, and when they had it, they didn't think he was that good, and yet he did develop into a pretty good player. I would think that even if it's by accident, if you have a good coach and a good scheme and you get guys to play up to their potential or even exceed their potential, you wouldn't even have to draft well. You'd have to just fall into guys that would become players that are at least satisfactory at the position. So when George was saying that Dallas is all top-heavy and completely empty at the bottom, is it really possible they can be empty at the bottom? I'm not sure in your comment whether that answered it. It seems to me like it sounds like, and I guess I'm not sure, it sounds like what you're saying is Jason Garrett did not scheme and did not get his guys to perform at the level they're supposed to. And it's not because the talent isn't there. It's that they didn't perform. Am I hearing you correctly there? Because to me,
exactly.
That has to be.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying is the fact that, you know, the talent is there, but I don't think that he did a good job of maximizing that talent. You know, you look at, you know, some of the guys, you know, you look at their receiving core, and I think that, you know, Dallas has a pretty soft receiving core. You know, Dez Bryant, you know, was a beast the last five, six weeks of the season. Miles Austin is still a very dependable wide receiver. You look at some of those younger guys, Kevin Ogletree, Dwayne Harris, Cole Beasley. You know, and as a whole, that's a pretty good group. But I don't think Garrett was able to maximize those guys, you know, to the effect that, you know, they really would have been difference makers. And that's what I'm saying. You know, like I said, you know, every team in the league, be it, you know, be it New England or, you know, or Kansas City, you know, from top to bottom, everyone's going to have bottom tier guys. And the way to me, the difference is that how do you use those guys? How do you scheme to make a guy that, you know, that might have one dimension? Like, say, for example, you've got a wide receiver that has great speed, but all he can do is just run go routes. How do you maximize a guy like that? How do you get him out there to be a difference maker? You know, how do you get a running back that has a certain skill to be a factor? And that's where the good coaching comes in. You know, you talk about Bill Belichick in New England. Now, obviously, Belichick has done wonders over the past decade plus on being able to maximize guys. You know, Troy Brown, Mike Vrabel, for example, he maximizes the talents of those guys. And I think that, you know, as a whole, I think that NFL coaches are scared to go outside the box. I really think that there's a lot of coaches in the league, and, you know, obviously some of those guys are fired. You know, everyone, you know, the NFL is a copycat league. And if there's something working, everyone's going to try to copy it. But to me, I think you still have a legion of coaches that are very afraid to think outside the box to maximize their talent. And I think that that failure is part of the reason why their teams fail and part of the reason why some of these guys don't have a job as of today.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, and I think Jason Garrett is the perfect example of that. You look at Sean Payton, his offense is different than everyone else's. It's not fundamentally drastically different than some other offenses that have been out there in the past, but he does it differently, more wide open, much more gunslinger than most teams do in the NFL and have done, even in a league that is a passing league. He has his beliefs, and he went out there and he did it and obviously became a world champion winner. You look at the Patriots. With what they're doing at the tight end position, they're changing the NFL game. Now, granted, the players in the NFL are changing slightly. Receivers that would have been maybe slow wide receivers are now bulking up a little bit and becoming maybe fast tight ends like a Hernandez and things like that. But nonetheless, the Patriots are changing the way the game is played offensively to some degree. The Patriots just stockpile tight ends. The focus of the Patriots offense now is Welker, for one, and two, the tight ends in the middle. And they signed Hernandez and Gronkowski for long-term deals. They're going to be here forever. That is different. The tight end was a guy that, I mean, what, 15 years ago, was essentially a blocking position, and a few of those guys that could catch were essential, were standouts and great players. But the tight end was, in a lot of cases, a blocking position. And now the Patriots have not had a good outside receiver other than Randy Moss since Belichick has been here. And they actually lost the Super Bowl with Moss on the team. So that's definitely different, and yet they go out there and do it. Then you look at Jason Garrett, and we were talking about this last night on Twitter as well. He seems like he plays extremely conservative, and this happened last night in the game as well. I think one of the main reasons why the Cowboys come back so well in the second half or the fourth quarter especially is Jason Garrett plays so conservative, and no matter how good of an offensive mind he is as a coordinator, he's too afraid to implement the game plan. And so he plays extremely conservative, very cautious, and you can tell that Romo just cannot really perform in that style of format. Then when they're behind, especially when they're down more than a score, when they're down one score, it seems like they're still conservative. But once they get down two scores or 10 points or 9 points where you need two scores, that's when they start opening up and throwing the ball like crazy. And I understand, of course, that defenses play a little bit differently when you've got a two-score lead versus a one-score lead, and that probably plays some role in it, of course. But nonetheless, I think the point is still valid, that when they become at least two scores down, they open it up and go crazy and cut loose, and then all of a sudden Dallas starts coming back. And when they were down 11, that game was not even close to over. Everyone said it's over when Alfred Morris ran that touchdown through that gaping hole called the field. His whole field was wide open when he ran that final touchdown. I think a lot of people thought the game was over. That game was not even close to over at that point. That game was very much in doubt after, and I had no doubt that it would be. To me, that's because of Jason Garrett. Until he absolutely has to open up and go wild, he doesn't. And I think that's why they put themselves in such difficult positions and why they kept losing all the time.
Oh, you're exactly right. You know, because, again, you know, you go back to the fact that, you know, you look at his receiving core. You know, and those guys weren't being maximized. You know, you've got a guy like Dwayne Harris, who I think, you know, has the potential to be a Percy Harvin-type guy in the league. You know, you've got guys like that, and you're not utilizing them in the manner that you should be. You know, and obviously Tony Romo thrives in an up-tempo offense, a more run-and-gun style. And Jason Garrett, you know, he stifles that to a certain extent. And again, it goes back to the fact that these guys are, you know, handcuffed by the fact that, you know, that there's, you know, this coach's Bible that they have that, you know, basically tells them, you know, on this down you should do this, on second and blank you should do that. And it's the guys that go out of character that are successful in the National Football League these days. The Belichicks, you know, the Paytons, or those guys that will go out of the box. You know, the league is changing. And I think a guy like a Chip Kelly, you know, regardless as to where he lands, if he goes to Philly, if he goes to Carolina, should Ron Rivera get fired? You know, and I think that Kelly's the type of guy with the offense that he runs in Oregon is going to be one of those guys that changes the landscape of the league. Here's a guy that, you know, is going to be creative. And, of course, he's going to have his critics saying that a college gimmick offense doesn't work. But look at what colleges are running now. A lot of spread. And a lot of these quarterbacks that come to the NFL are well-versed in spread. Unfortunately, they have to adapt to, you know, the quote-unquote pro style to where, you know, it takes away from them. You know, you look at Alex Smith. Alex Smith is at his best when he's let loose and able to run, a spread-type offense. But when you're asking him to, you know, go I formation, in and off the Frank Gore, you know, play action, you know, things like that, you take away some of this effectiveness. You know, quarterback is a very important, you know, it's the most important position in the National Football League today. And if you look at the depth of talent in the NFL, you know, I'd probably say there's about, say, 23 to 25 teams that are quite happy or very happy with their quarterbacks as of right now. I think that the teams that are able to get quarterbacks, whoever's making their changes in the offseason, if you build your offense around your quarterback's strengths instead of what you were taught, you see results. Drew Brees ran a spread offense, a shotgun-style offense, and at Purdue. And once he went to New Orleans, Sean Payton didn't put him under center. Sean Payton gave him a shotgun, and Drew Brees has been one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL ever since. And again, that's the problem. You do not, you know, a lot of these coaches do not let their quarterbacks thrive to their strengths. You know, and it's just plain and simple. You know, you allow these guys to utilize their strengths, and a lot of these coaches don't do that.
Yeah, and one, we need to focus a little bit on each team, the kind of the winners and the losers and the, I guess, the tires of yesterday's game, and that is a transition into the Redskins. They talked about it last night. I thought this was fascinating, that when they drafted RG3, they looked at all the college teams that were running what is essentially this pistol offense, or anyone anywhere that's running it. They looked at all this tape, and they basically, from scratch, took all of that information and created the offense that is now the pistol in the NFL. And granted, Carolina ran maybe something like what the Redskins run now, so maybe the Redskins didn't do it first. But nonetheless, they created a style of offense out of nothing when they got RG3. That's interesting, and you can't tell me that most teams would ever do that. As a matter of fact, I would say 9 times out of 10 that they would not. And that's interesting, A, in what they've been able to do, and then I guess I want to expand it a little bit. A, since you mentioned Alex Smith, he was the kind of pistol-style offense that when he was in college and he was a high-round pick. What would Alex Smith's career be like, and how would San Francisco or whoever ended up with Alex Smith after it seems like the 49ers no longer need him? If Alex Smith was running what RG3 is now running, now he doesn't run as well as RG3, but Alex Smith, at least in college, ran very well. What do you think Alex Smith would be able to do if he had an offense like RG3 has now, with obviously you'd have to have a runner, and in San Francisco they had Gore. But if he ran this style of offense like he did when he was in college, what kind of a player do you think Alex Smith would be?
I think that he would be a very good quarterback. I think that, you know, if you utilized it, you know, in the way that he was in Utah, I think he'd be an outstanding quarterback. I think that, you know, he would be, you know, a well above average quarterback. I'm not saying he'd be, you know, a Brady type guy, Brady Breeze, you know, in a top tier type of guy, but I think he'd be a very solid second tier guy, you know, along the lines of, say, a Matt Schaub or Eli Manning or, you know, a quarterback like that. I think that if you put him in a situation that utilizes the strengths, he's going to be good. You know, and I think that, you know, if whoever signs, you know, say, for example, Michael Vick in the offseason, and you utilize, you know, Michael Vick's strengths, build your offense to his strengths, I think that this is a guy that would thrive. And again, it goes back to the fact that a lot of these coaches try to make these guys something that they're not. You know, you look at Michael Vick's time in Philadelphia. You know, you look at, you know, to a certain extent, Donovan McNabb. You know, Andy Reid tried to make these guys something that they truly were not. Now, McNabb adapted fairly well, but at the expense of taking away his ability to scramble. Michael Vick tried to thrive as, you know, a pocket passer, but obviously that didn't work. When Michael Vick was tearing it up in the National Football League in 2010, it was because Andy Reid entrusted him to play a wide-open style of offense. But when you're asking this guy to be a classic drop-back passer, you know, it takes away from him. I think, you know, the days, you know, they're still classic drop-back passers, but that can't be the NFL mantra anymore because these kids in high school and in college are not playing classic drop-back. I would venture to say, having seen enough high school football over the last 20-some-odd years, I would venture to say that at least 65 to 70% of high school quarterbacks are not running a pro style of offense. And those guys that advance to the next level aren't going to end up playing in a pro style offense. And those guys who eventually get to the National Football League are probably not going to be as well versed. You know, you look at Tebow's problem. Tim Tebow, I think, is a classic example. You know, yeah, everyone disputes the fact that, you know, whether or not he can play quarterback in the NFL, that's neither here nor there for right now. But if you were to put Tim Tebow in a
call is now being recorded.
All right, everybody, sorry about that. We had a little bit of technical difficulty, but Brandon, go ahead. You were talking about how athleticism is really becoming an important thing. I think you're right on par there. Essentially, what we're looking at now is quarterbacks that are less about the technique of the position, and there is really more about their athleticism, and they're using their skills and that athleticism to their advantage. And so, therefore, running is obviously becoming a much larger part of the position. And that's what makes guys like RG3 and Andrew Luck not just good, but elite, is that not only can they run like a lot of the quarterbacks can do now, but they can also pass extremely well as well. I would say that's essentially what you were getting at there.
Exactly.
Yeah, but my question to you is, A, I don't know if Michael Vick, I think he has a little bit too much run and not quite enough throw in his repertoire. I think that's really been his problem. Is A, he's a little bit too fragile, for one. He can't stay healthy. And that's going to be my question once I kind of finish here is, Vic could not stay healthy running. And he wasn't quite good enough of a passer to mix and match both. Because you have to pass well, especially like a Steve Young did and why he was a Hall of Famer, is he was able to run, but he was good enough of a passer where he didn't have to run all the time. With Vic, it seems like he's not quite a good enough passer where he just has to run too much and he takes too many hits. Now, what's great about Robert Griffin III is, accuracy-wise, he's about as good as anybody. And he's only a rookie now. But as you see him get better and better and better, I think you're going to see almost like a Tom Brady who can run not quite like a Michael Vick, but really very much close enough. That's what I think is so appealing about a Robert Griffin III. And that's one of the things that makes Andrew Luck better than just good is he can run. He's not a running quarterback by any means. You'd never mistake him with RG3. But he's not just standing there immobile in the pocket. He can run plenty well enough to survive and to even make that part of his game. But my question is, with this pistol offense, the way that the Redskins are using now, It helps a lot that they've got a legitimate threat at running back as well. If you had a bad runner, then the pistol is not going to work as anywhere near as well, because you wouldn't scare anybody if you weren't at least a little bit afraid of the running back. And that's why I think Alfred Morris is such a big part of that offense also, and we'll get into that as well. But can you run the pistol the way they're running it now for 8 years in a row? Or they're talking about how Griffin has to learn how to get hit, and he has to learn how to avoid hits. But if he's rushing the ball 15 times, 10, 15 times a game, even if he avoids a few hits like he should, he's still going to take more than his fair share of hits. Is he going to be able to do that and play that style for even more than 4 or 5 years? And that's if he avoids a major injury. Do you think that they can run this style of offense for the long term? Could the NFL change to that degree? I mean, it just seems like the guys are too big and too strong and too fast to allow quarterbacks to run like they are right now. I mean, Cam Newton's a monster of a man, so maybe he can handle it. But most quarterbacks aren't that big. Do you think that this offense can really hang on for that long based on just the beating they're going to take?
I think that it can hang on. You know, and again, there's that belief that, you know, offense that, you know, that the NFL is unfamiliar with, you know, obviously is one of those that, you know, most pundits will say is eventually going to be figured out. You know, obviously the run and shoot, you know, 20 years ago was kind of an empty, but it had its flaws. You know, the pistol has its flaws, and you mentioned the fact that quarterbacks will get hit a lot more often if you're running it. But you can modify that. You know, there are so many things that you can do based out of that pistol. And I think that's the thing that makes the Redskins even more scary, because as RG3 continues to develop his game, especially as a passer, I think you'll see him running less. And I think that that will make him even more dangerous for when the times that he does run, it's going to scare the daylights out of opponents. Now, I mean, not every team is going to be capable of running that, but I think that we are in the early stages of a trend that's going to take over the National Football League. You know, and the Wildcat is still kind of there, but, you know, it was kind of like a fad. But this thing with the pistol-style offense has legs, because a lot of these kids that are coming out of college either run the pistol naturally or they're playing some version of the pistol. And, again, it behooves me that you've got NFL coaches that won't utilize these guys. You know, and you look at a guy like a Colin Kaepernick who played the pure pistol at Nevada under Chris Alt. You know, you look at a guy like Kaepernick, and I think obviously, you know, it would be in the best interest of Jim Harbaugh, and I think he's done that to a certain extent, to utilize aspects of the pistol to maximize the talent. He's got a guy in Frank Gore. He's got another kid in LaMichael James, a guy that, you know, has won in the pistol. And to me, I think that's the thing. The very thing that Washington is showing is that you can win in this style of offense. You've got to have the right formula, yes. But I think it's proven that you can win in this offense. And I promise you, if the Redskins were to somehow make a run to the NFC Championship under this offense, you're going to see a lot of copycatting going on. And you're going to see a lot of NFL teams reaching, some maybe a little earlier, for kids that have played under the system in the hopes of trying to duplicate that success.
I agree with you and disagree with you at the same time. I think we are going to see it used more often for teams that have players like that, but I don't think it's going to be what people want to do. I don't think it's going to be a preference. I think it's going to be an alternative. And the reason being, I just don't think teams could run this offense consistently game in and game out for 5 years in a row at a stretch. I just don't think you can do that. So I don't think you're going to see it as a complete offense. But I think what you might do is a situation like the Jets, where they don't have the weapons on the outside at wide receiver. They don't have a great tight end. They don't have a great passing quarterback like a Brady or a Manning or a Rodgers. They don't have those types of guys. And when you don't have those type of guys, you've got to do something else. You've got to run better, or you need to scheme better, or like the 49ers, you've got to do misdirection and things like that. If you don't have that elite special guy, then you need to find alternatives. And in those cases, I think you'll see some people going to the pistol in order to do that, because one of the things that it really truly does is, A, it creates indecision on the part of the defense. And to some degree, or a lot of it, it can really, at least momentarily, freeze really good, great athleticism. Because your DN has to stay on position. He can't just he can't just rush up the field to go at the guy because you don't know if it's going to go to the running back, you don't know if it's going to go to the fullback, you don't know if the quarterback's going to throw it. He's got to pause for that just that second, and so you create thinking rather than just pure physical action. So in that way, the offense, just because of those the style, it benefits you in that way. If you got DeMarcus Ware charging up on the end from the very snap of the ball, that's what he's at his best. If you're making him pause and think for just a second and then start upfield, that helps you. and so for that, because of that alone, it's an offense that works well. And two, it makes everybody, not just a DeMarcus Ware, but it makes everybody on the defensive line, it makes everybody on the D end, it makes the safeties, it makes everybody think for just a moment. And that is a good thing for an offense against the defense. So in that way, it makes them play, honest. They can't cheat. They can't just surge upfield. So in that way, it's a good offense. But again, I just don't think people can run this style of offense consistently, because I just think you're going to get beat up. And another thing, and this, like we kind of touched on a little bit before, once somebody gets a significant injury, if RG3, like that leg injury, he got away pretty easy there. But if that was a torn ACL and he's out for the next year and a half, I don't think you'd see the pistol anywhere. You know, you look at a guy with the potential of RG3, with the marketing money that's involved, ignoring the game itself. You look at the figure that is RG3 out there. All of a sudden, he's out for a year and a half. Teams don't want to lose that, obviously, on the field, but they don't want to lose that off the field either. If you saw him out for a year and a half, I think that would scare to death a lot of teams that have an RG3 type guy. Now, it wouldn't stop people from using an Alex Smith in this role or those kinds of situations. But I think once we see a major injury or even a career kind of, at least if not ended, significantly altered because of a significant injury, then all of a sudden teams would get extremely afraid of running this style of offense. And whether they should be or not, that's just the reality, and we talked about that before. And I think that would happen. If you've got 10 or 12 teams running what RG3 runs every single week on a consistent basis, somebody's going to have a significant injury. If it's Alex Smith, not the end of the world. But if it's RG3 or Andrew Luck or what Colin Kaepernick could become, all of a sudden that's a different story altogether. And the NFL is changing rules every day to protect quarterbacks. So I think the coaches on its own would kind of adjust just to do that, because these guys in the NFL are so big and strong now. I just don't think you can run that style. But I think you will see it as an alternative. I agree with you on that. And it's almost, that would be a good thing if you're Rex Ryan in New York. If he could, and I think Rex Ryan's a little too stubborn to be able to do this, and we touched on that as well. But I think bringing Alex Smith into New York and trying to run this style of offense a little bit, if Alex Smith can run it, because he did run it in college, or a guy like that, I think that could do pretty well for a team like the Jets and at least get them competitive. And remember, the Jets were competitive for a lot of this season already, as bad as we know they are. They were competitive going late into the season. Let's talk a little bit about the teams as well. We talked about the Dallas Cowboys, the teams that were most impacted by yesterday's games. Let's talk about the losers first. We talked about the Cowboys. Now let's talk about the Giants and the Bears. The Giants did everything they had to yesterday against a Philly team that, again, it kind of boggles the mind that a team with a coach that good, with athleticism that good, and yet Philly is just that bad. That shocks me, and we'll talk a lot about that as the season comes to an end, and we'll talk about the NFL on the whole. But the Giants did everything they needed to do yesterday, but unfortunately the last month they did everything they could do to lose this thing, and it finally came to a head on Sunday. Did you see anything in that game for the Giants that made you think that they could have been a dangerous team in the playoffs that would really even make the season more disappointing? That if they were able to somehow sneak in yesterday, they could have been a Super Bowl contender. Did you see anything in that game that could lead you to believe that? Or did they end up kind of getting what they deserved, and that they're a good team, but they're not a great team? Did we kind of overrate them for most of the season?
I think we did overrate them for most of the season, but I think if you looked at that game yesterday, it was a huge case of what might have been. Now, granted, they were playing a Philadelphia team that had all but faxed in the regular season at that point, but at the same time, you got a sense of what this team could have been. And you really feel, I really think that, you know, this Giants team, you know, kind of crumbled under the pressure of the expectations. You know, they got to the Super Bowl. They made that frantic run last season, got hot at the right time, and they obviously went to the Super Bowl. And I think you and I, with a lot of other people, thought that after that Saints game, after their bye week, that this was the beginning of that Giants run, that we're starting to see this team put it all together. We were proven wrong. I think that this was a team that, you know, that was just completely worn down by the end of that, before they got the bye. And yes, you know, that Saints game, you know, it made them look good offensively and everything, but, you know, a combination of injuries, and you know, I think just a team that was just mentally worn down, you know, was willing to cope for this to why they're not in the playoffs.
Yeah, it could be, but I guess that's the question then. If they're worn down, why aren't the Patriots worn down? How did the Patriots manage to do it? Plus, I mean, the Patriots are pretty young. Do you think that's why? Why are the Giants worn down? And why, I mean, was it Eli Manning, or was it those linemen that are supposed to be so good on the defensive line, they just mentally couldn't handle it this season? Or, I mean, why is the Patriots and Belichick just so good? Is Belichick such a good leader that that's why the Patriots do it year in and year out, whereas the Giants are good and Kaufman's a good coach, but you know, sometimes you just have off years. Is that kind of what you're saying?
I think one of the underlooked reasons why the Giants aren't in the playoffs is that you lost Hakeem Nicks for a significant part of the season. I think if you look at that, Hakeem Nicks was a big factor in their run last season. And when he went down, the offense kind of lost, you know, their go-to guy. Now, Brandon Victor Cruz is a good wide receiver, but Hakeem Nicks is the best receiver on that roster. And without him at 100% for most of the year, I think that really affected Eli Manning and the fact that he wasn't able to get his go-to guy. And I think you also have to look at the fact that Amon Bradshaw was really worn down. You know, he came into the season nicked up. You know, he gutted it out for most of the year, but you know, really was not the Amon Bradshaw that we've seen in prior years. And it took a little while for them to get a little trust in Wilson and the backfield. And I think that, you know, this is still a very good team. And I think that, you know, with a few tweaks in the offseason, I think that you're going to see the Giants right back in the thick of things as a legitimate NFC championship contender. You got to remember, Joe, this is a team that has two Super Bowl wins in the last five seasons. You've got, you know, Eli Manning at his peak. You've got a lot of talent on that defense. And I think that, you know, it's just a case of, you know, an offseason like this is kind of a wake-up call. They tweak a few things, and I think that they're going to come in a little more hungry and a little more focused because of the fact that they know full well that they dropped the opportunity to defend their championship. They dropped an opportunity big time, and I think that's one of those things that's going to drive them during the offseason.
Yeah, they had an interesting season. I think we probably overrated them just because in the past they've somehow been able to just flip the switch and win when you needed to, and we thought talent-wise they should be able to do that, and they didn't. Maybe we just kind of overrated them a little bit all year, giving them that kind of credit, just assuming that all they had to do was flip the switch and all of a sudden they'd be able to do it. And it seemed like the bye week came perfectly to feed into that kind of reputation. Because we thought, all right, they're exhausted. They had a late season bye, which means maybe they were stumbling, they were exhausted and stumbling in. That bye week would give them that rejuvenation that would allow them to get back and playing good football. And maybe it just all played in perfectly to that kind of theory. And it turns out it just wasn't. It wasn't meant to be. The team isn't quite as good. Let me ask you this. In New England, they get a lot of credit for being able to run the ball with just about anybody. They've got Ridley. They've got Vereen. They've got Bolden. They've got Woodhead. They've got a lot of guys there, and yet they run the ball consistently well. They almost get credit for that. And without having a great running back, they're able to run well. I think the Patriots almost get credit for being able to do that. It seems like the Giants, they get the opposite. And they had Brandon Jacobs, he's not there now, but when they had him and they used Bradshaw and they used that dual head situation, now they've got Wilson and Bradshaw and Brown when he was healthy. It seems like the Giants, it's almost like rather than giving them credit for being able to run decently well with multiple guys, it seems like we look at the Giants and say their running game is disappointing. You're hoping that they would get it going. Yet they still run the ball reasonably well. They're not one of the best ranked teams in the league, but is this a perception thing, or is it something about the Giants where their running game is disappointing, even though they've got some pretty talented backs? Because Bradshaw, he can't seem to stay healthy. Jacobs is gone now. Brown got injured. But Wilson has shown some signs of being pretty interesting. I don't think he can be a full-time, you know, 500 carries a year type of guy. He seems a little bit too small for that. But it looks like we should be giving them credit for running, whereas I almost think that people look at them as being disappointing. It's like almost like they see a lot of potential in it, but yet it doesn't quite reach it. Whereas with the Patriots, it almost seems like expectations are really low, so they easily exceed expectations. Am I wrong there, or is this Giants running game truly disappointing? Because if they're going to do everything they want to do in future years, I would think Bradshaw and Wilson and Brown to some degree, that running game is going to have to be able to be consistent to allow Manning to do all the throwing he wants to do and all the different things. Has this running game been disappointing, or is it expectations in kind of the way we see them? Is it perception rather than reality?
I think there's a certain level of disappointment with the way the Giants run, but I think the real big difference to me is that, you know, the Patriots are more of a finesse team when it comes to running the ball mostly. You know, they're able to, you know, utilize their outset, you know, utilize the strengths of their running backs, whereas with the Giants, they're a little more physical, and I think that takes a toll. You know, I also think that, you know, you also have to take a look at the fact that the Giants play in a very rugged division in the NFC East, where you've got, you know, long-standing rivalries and hard-hitting defenses for the most part. And whereas, you know, New England, you know, faces, you know, some physical teams, you know, obviously, you know, the Jets tend to be more physical. But I think that also has to play in that as well. Now, whereas you've got six games where you're banging up against the likes of Dallas, Philadelphia, and Washington. You know, it takes a toll, especially with the style of offense that they run. It's more of a using that power running game to set up the pass. And it does take a toll on their backs.
Yeah, it's interesting because they're going to have to figure it out. I mean, Eli's a good quarterback, no doubt about it. They've got a lot of talent on offense. It really seems like there's just way too much talent for that team to not have made the playoffs. We talk about Dallas and how disappointing they are. Would you say that the Giants are probably more disappointing? I mean, if you really look at it, because of how much talent they have on the defensive side and the fact that DeMarco Murray was so injured for Dallas, which has really hampered their running game over the season, I don't think Dallas was one of the worst running teams.
This call is now being recorded.
All right, everybody, sorry about that. We seem to be having some technical difficulties with the different weather and everything. What we were talking about before was the Giants and whether they're disappointing or not, and What the point that I was making, and I'm going to kind of start over, and if I repeat myself a little bit from before, I apologize, but with these technical difficulties, we're trying to move along here in trying situations. We're talking about whether Dallas and the Giants, which team has been more disappointing, and my point was that because DeMarco Murray was injured, Dallas, at the end of the day, at the end of the season, accumulatively, Dallas was considered one of the worst running teams in the league, but I think when DeMarco Murray was healthy, you probably would not have called the Cowboys one of the worst running games in the league. But because he was injured so much of the time, it accumulated to the point where they were one of the worst running offenses across the league. But you look at the Giants, and I would say they're more disappointing league-wide because, A, they did have three running backs, even though Brown got hurt. Bradshaw missed some games as well. But you look at what the Giants had on the offensive side as well as the defensive side with all those defensive linemen that are seen as really an elite defensive line that did not perform that way. As much as we think that Romo blew it and the Cowboys are really disappointing, at least I think they're very disappointing, would you say that the Giants, other than maybe more so than the Eagles, but really this NFC East, I consider that one of the better divisions, but you look at it, Philly and the Giants, are they two of the most disappointing teams across the entire NFL this season? And we'll get into this a lot more in future weeks, but because we're kind of doing a postmortem on week 17 here, and we're talking about the teams that were hurt most, would you say the Giants, because they weren't able to get into the playoffs, maybe, if not the most disappointing season in the NFL, one of the top two or three along with Philly?
I think that they're right up there at the top. You know, and again, this was the defending Super Bowl champions. And yes, they had their fair share of injuries. But they also failed to take advantage of the fact that for most of the season, they were clearly the best team in the NFC East. They weren't able to finish the job. And I think that's a certain level of disappointment, you know, along the field with that. You know, yes, they had injuries. So did everyone for the most part. But, you know, they just weren't able to adapt. You know, again, I think the game against Cincinnati after they beat the Saints, I think the game against Cincinnati was kind of like that clarion call that maybe this team was running out of gas. We're trying to give them, like you said, the benefit of the doubt. We did this all season long. We gave them the benefit of the doubt because they're the Giants. We've seen them do this before, and they're the defending Super Bowl champs. And I think that, you know, after that Eagles game, this was a team that was running out of gas, and it really showed, you know, down the stretch. And you see, it looks like we got something breaking on the NFL Network that's official that, you know, Ken Whisenhunt is now fired.
And we're going to definitely get into that, but that looked like something that could be coming. We can put him as the up in the air now to an officially gone now. Interesting. All right. Let's touch a little bit more on, let's talk about the Bears now. We talked about Washington a little bit. We talked about the Cowboys. We talked about the Giants. That NFC East is an interesting division. You look at them and you say, you know, all of these teams are talent-wise on the roster good enough to make the playoffs, and yet only one of them made it. It's interesting, yeah. But let's look over to the Bears now. Lovie Smith obviously got fired. Really, a significant part of that has to be because he wasn't able to put a strong, consistent offense on the field there. He's a defensive guy. They've always had good defenses while he's been there. They did everything they had to do to miss the playoffs as well. Now, I love to take credit for things, and I thought the Bears would miss the playoffs going back quite some time. I thought it would be hard for them to miss because they really had to do a lot to screw it up. But they did it. They did what they needed to do to screw it up, and what happened? They did win on Sunday, which is what they needed to do on Sunday, but they didn't get the help that they needed, mostly because of the Vikings, which really was a fantastic performance by them to be able to beat the Pack. I don't know if I'm to blame Cutler for everything, because he wasn't even there for all of the years. But is Lovie Smith a good enough coach where if he had a really good quarterback, he's a guy that could stay there for a long time? Or do you think he's a good defensive guy, but maybe not a great head coach? Because he didn't have a good quarterback before Cutler, and we've talked a lot about the weaknesses and the flaws in Cutler's game as well. I'm not ready to say that Cutler sank Lovie, but I am ready to say that he certainly did not help Lovie. Let's put it that way. Whoever goes in there, could a coach go in there and maximize Cutler's abilities? Or is that really just a position where whoever goes there, they're pretty much screwed because, A, Cutler is there and he's going to screw them, and, B, and you're in trouble there too. Is that really a bad job to go into now?
It is a bad job because of Jay Cutler. Jay Cutler's one of those guys that, you know, it seems like we talk about every week for some reason or another. And I think the fact that with Cutler, he's a talented quarterback. No one doubts the physical ability of Jay Cutler. But it's that mental ability that, at this point, I don't think he's ever going to reach. And you're stuck with this guy because he made the commitment to him. And, yeah, you know, it's not completely his fault that Lovie Smith got fired, but I do think it is a contributing factor as to why he got fired. You know, when you've got in a quarterback that, you know, has all the talent that, yet for some reason or another, is unable to tap into that potential, it's a very frustrating proposition for you. And if you look at this Bears team, that, you know, yeah, there's some talent there, but I think there's a team that has a window of opportunity that's slowly beginning to shut because you're not taking it because of the fact that Jay Cutler has not maximized his ability. And with that, it keeps this Bears team from being able to maximize. You know, I mean, when they were 7-1, I think both of us were in agreement that, you know, this might be one of the three or four best teams in the National Football League, even with Cutler's struggles. But they cratered down the stretch. And again, you know, a lot of that was on Cutler. You know, you can also mention the fact that the injury of Brian Urlacher also hurt them as well, that they were way too reliant on Brandon Marshall for the most part. There are a lot of contributing factors there, but whoever gets that job in Chicago has got to deal with a quarterback that, you know, really, you know, is probably never going to reach his potential. And it's going to be frustrating that you go in there with the belief that you can try to turn this team around and try to turn Jay Cutler around. You know, he's the girl with the curl. You know, he's never going to be good over an extended stretch.
Yeah, and Marshall had a fantastic season statistically. So obviously we know Cutler can do some things, but I love Matt Forte, don't get me wrong, but it seems like maybe Matt Forte isn't quite the right guy for a Lovie Smith style offense, because he seems like he'd be perfect for an Andy Reid type offense in Philly, those kinds of things. But it seems like they just didn't utilize Forte as much, and he couldn't stay healthy either. So Forte kind of needs to be babied, almost like a Reggie Bush was in New Orleans. It's a tough guy, seems to be able to fully maximize their talents, and I don't think that he was in Chicago, and maybe it takes a special kind of situation to be able to do that. But and that Bears, they, obviously they're a great football town. They've got a good team. They've got good ownership for the most part. I wonder who would want to go there. I would assume anyone would love to go there, because any team, an organization that has the legacy and the fans that Chicago has, I'm sure that is a good job. I'm sure anyone would love to go there. But if you are, like you looked at it, if you look at it subjectively, taking on Jay Cutler, to me, is taking on a situation that you're – it's going to be extremely difficult. I work with people in my business, and there are certain guys that have talents, but you just can't get them to do what you want to do. They just don't do it. You can't understand why. You say, wow, you have all this potential, but yet for some reason you just won't do what I tell you the way I tell you to do it. And it seems like with Cutler – that's going to be the case, and you just can't get away from that talent, and that's really going to hurt. I wonder if an Andy Reid wants to go to Philly, I go to Chicago. It seems like if Andy Reid wants to coach in 2013, my guess is a couple teams would be more than happy to take him on, and it seems like the Bears might be a situation where Andy Reid would like it, and maybe he could turn Cutler into something, but again, I don't think so. I think that's a really tough job. But it is what it is. Let's finish up talking about the teams that really were important there. We'll talk about the Vikings a little bit more when we talk about the playoff picture, so we won't touch on them here. But let's finish it up. I think we have to talk about the Houston Texans. We're going to talk about them more as we analyze the games coming up next week. But if there's any team that really was the most disappointing, of course, missing the playoffs, and that's the Cowboys, the Bears, and the Giants. Those teams missing the playoffs, of course, you've got to say that they really blew an opportunity. So they probably are the biggest losers of Week 17. But you look at the Texans, and it looks like they're going to be one and done the way they're playing right now. The way they played the last 5 or 6 weeks, they went from the cursed zone that we had them in Week 7 or 8, where we had them as the best team in the NFL, to now a team that looks like they can't beat anybody. They're really playing really poorly. Matt Schaub is just getting crucified for not, A, being able to make the throws, and B, the offense not being really very aggressive, being very predictable. Even with an Arian Foster and J.J. Watt, Arian Foster, I believe, leads the NFL in touchdowns. J.J. Watt is even being discussed as an MVP, though a defensive player never gets MVP, so that's probably not legitimate. But he's been so good that he's at least discussed as MVP, never mind best defensive player. Having a fantastic season. It's amazing at how poorly the Texans are playing. They just can't even score touchdowns right now. And it's not like the Colts are a monster defense. The Colts had no interest really in that game. They couldn't move anywhere in the playoff standings. The only thing the Colts had going for them was they were at home and they were inspired by their coach coming back. And I don't think you can underestimate how much that helped, because it really did seem like they played in pretty inspired football yesterday. But even that, I mean, 3rd and 23, and T.Y. Hilton turns in a touchdown where he was untouched. How do you get a 3rd and 23 and end up with a 75-yard touchdown without even being touched by a defender? What is going on with the Texans? And could you imagine that they actually could win this weekend after the way they played the last 5 or 6 weeks?
No, and I think that going into this postseason, I said that the Bengals were one team no one wanted to face. And I think that this is going to be the case for the Texans. This is not the same Cincinnati team that they faced last year in the wild card. This is a much better, well-balanced team on both sides of the ball. I think the problem with the Texans is that, they were overrated. If you look at their regular season schedule, they went into this season with the second easiest schedule in the National Football League. And if you look at their schedule, who did they beat? They beat a Baltimore team a week after they lost Ladarius Webb and Ray Lewis, arguably two of their three best defensive players. But you look at the teams that they lost to. Green Bay went into Reliance Stadium and trounced them in Week 6. They got humiliated by the Patriots, on the Monday night game a few weeks back. They lost to a Vikings team that is in the playoffs. They lost to a Colts team that's in the playoffs. They were able to beat up on inferior opponents. And as much grief as we gave the Broncos about playing a fairly weak schedule, I think the same thing should have been made for the Texans, because it was basically the same thing. They were running up, loading their schedule, and been looking good against cupcakes. But I think that Detroit game really started sending signals that maybe this team really isn't
Yeah, I mean, it could be. And even it started with the Jaguars. I believe that was the week before.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, the Jaguars are not a good team, and I think what we did was we chalked that game up to as a fluke, and flukes happen. I mean, the NFL is a game of inches. The worst teams give the best teams the game sometimes, so we pretty easily chalked that up to that. But you look at the schedule, and like you said, I mean, they won their first five, and that's really where they established themselves as possibly the best team in the NFL. But those teams were Miami, Jacksonville, Denver, which we didn't really know what Denver was at that time. And Denver has played a lot better since week three when they lost to Houston. But they beat Miami, Jacksonville, Tennessee, the Jets. They lost to Green Bay. They got trounced by Green Bay, which maybe that should have been a sign of something we should have paid attention to. Then they beat Baltimore, and then they had a bye week. Then they beat Buffalo, beat Chicago, beat Jacksonville, beat Detroit, beat Tennessee. So they did keep winning. I mean, you look at that, up until week 13, they were 12-1. There's a good reason to know why they were rated where they were. But yes, you look at the teams that they beat. Chicago, by week 10, we started to see some chinks in that armor. But other than that, and losing to Green Bay, you're right. They really didn't have a very difficult schedule. I mean, that goes to my point is I just don't think the NFL is that good this year. It's exciting. I love the NFL, but it's very much parity. There is no dominant team. There's no great team. The Houston Texans we thought were, but you look back at the schedule, because of the so many mediocre teams, maybe the record is deceiving because they lost to the Colts handily. They got trounced by Minnesota in a game that was extremely important for them, and they lost that at home, and they only had 6 points. They didn't even score a touchdown in that game. They did beat the Colts a few weeks back, trounced by New England. Even if they aren't as good as we thought they were, they're not this bad, right? I mean, what are they doing that makes them this bad? They got to be better than this, even if we overdo them. I mean, if we thought them on a scale of 1 to 10, we thought they were a 10. They're not a 4, right? And isn't that what they're playing like? They're playing like a 4 at this point. What can they do to pull out at least one game and maybe at least become a contender? Would a bye week have even mattered? Can they get it together in a bye week if they were able to get that bye week where they can all of a sudden come out and be a contender? Or is this team pretty much destined to lose in week one?
I think that they desperately needed the bye week. I think without question they were the one team that desperately needed it. But now they're going into a playoff game where they've lost 3 out of their last 4. 2 of those quite humiliating. And you face a Cincinnati team that comes in on a roll. And this is, again, a Bengals team that's not the same Bengals team that they faced last year. This Cincinnati team is more physical. They've got more ability to move the ball offensively. And I think that teams, as yesterday showed, I think that teams are not scared of the Texans anymore. I think teams now realize that this is a fairly soft team that you can push around. And, again, as I mentioned at the start of the show, their offense is so predictable. You know, and there's been a lot of the talk and there's been a lot of the discussion in the Houston Sports Talk shows today, is that this team is so predictable on the offensive side of the ball that there's no creativity coming from Gary Kubiak, that, you know, you can shut your eyes and you can guess what they're going to run. And that's a huge problem with them right now. You know, if they lose on Saturday to the Bengals, and I honestly think they will. If they lose, you know, who does the blame fall on? You know, they're not going to get rid of Wade Phillips. You know, and I think that, you know, is it going to fall on Rick Dennison, a long-time Kubiak guy? Who knows? But someone and somewhere, the blame has to lie. So why this team jumped out to a 12-1 start, didn't limp into the postseason, and it was a one-and-done? The fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, like you said, this was not a good team. This was a good team, yes, but they were not a great team by any stretch of the imagination. They have basically been fool's gold. And I think that, you know, the fact that they have played somewhat fraudulent over the past 4 weeks shows that.
And who is it? Because you're down there, so you see a lot more about them than do. I mean, Arian Foster had a rough week a couple weeks back, but he was, you know, he had the irregular heartbeat and so forth. Watts still looks as dominant as ever from what I saw in yesterday's game. Who's not getting it done there? It seems like the blame is falling on Schaub, and you've been talking a lot of the last few weeks about the the mediocre and predictable play calling. Are there any players on the field? Because Jonathan Joseph's back, and we thought of him as an elite corner. But who on the field has really been disappointing, and how much of the blame belongs on the play calling?
I think if you start pointing at players that they call, Connor Barwin and outside linebackers had something of a letdown season. He had a great year last year. A lot of people thought that, you know, he was going to really step forward and take that next step, kind of like J.J. Watt. But, you know, he has had something of a letdown season. Kareem Jackson, early on in the year, looked like, you know, he was probably turning around and being the cornerback that the Texans had wanted him to be since they drafted him. But since, you know, maybe about week 12, week 13, he has been, you know, that same Jackson that has been, you know, basically picked on frequently throughout his career. I think those are two guys you can look at. I think if you look on the offensive side of the ball, I really think that, you know, that kind of like Chicago, I think there's too much of a reliance on Andre Johnson. Now, Kevin Walters, a good, competent wide receiver, but he's not a guy that, you know, you can look at and say, you know, he's a game changer. That, you know, teams focus on Andre Johnson, we can get the ball to him and make plays. He's not that kind of guy. But I think that, you know, the question that they lack speed on the outside, you know, the two guys, they went and drafted Kavir Posey. He also drafted Kareem Martin at wide receiver during his past draft. But at the same time, these guys really have not immersed themselves at the pace that a lot of people thought that they would. I think that right now, you're looking at a team that, you know, again, they're one-dimensional. You know that they're going to go to Foster. You know that they're going to go to Johnson. Well, those guys are all pro-caliber guys, but at the same time, you've got to show some diversity.
Now, it seems like when they were at their best, they were a run-first team, and Schaub was just kind of taking advantage of the fact that you had to really defend the run. It seemed like they were a good physical team, both on both sides of the ball, defensively, but more importantly on offense. It was a running team. They pounded the ball on you with Tate and Foster and Forsett even to a little bit of a degree. It seems like they could have utilized him a little bit more, but he was in the mix a little bit. But once that Jags game, and in some of those games, obviously, when you're down big or something, you have to go to the passing game, and of course I understand that. That wasn't by design. It was by necessity. But it seems like after that, it's almost like Kubiak wants to be a passing team, and because you've got Andre Johnson, you think that you can be. But Andre Johnson's aging. Coming into this year, he was seen as a guy that was kind of dropping off, especially in fantasy circles, which is, I think, a lot of people's opinions are formed there, even if it's not necessarily fair or accurate. But nonetheless, I think they're formed there. And really, this team isn't about Schaub. It shouldn't be about Schaub because he is not an elite guy. He's not even a second-tier guy. He's a game manager guy, but he's probably got a little bit more talent than what a game manager has to be. But he's in that game manager, I think, title. That's what I would say. He's a talented game manager rather than a talented guy who also doesn't make mistakes. And it seems like after that Jaguars game where he really had to be slinging it and had a very good game, did Kubiak all of a sudden, because I just feel like Kubiak wants to be a passing guy. He was a quarterback, never really a successful QB, but a career backup to John Elway. And it seems to me like my instinct is that he wants to be an offensive passing guru. And in the Texans, he just doesn't have that. And really, the Texans can't be that with Schaub. But nonetheless, I think he wants to be that. Is that where the problem went? Did they become less physical because they started being more of a passing team? Did they go more to the passing game? Because Andre Johnson had a fantastic second half, while Arian Foster was good, because Arian Foster is good. I mean, you give him the ball, he performs. But it seems like he could have been better. And granted, they wanted to keep him healthy. They wanted to, durability-wise, they didn't want to give him all the touches. But nonetheless, it seems like Tate was injured as well, and maybe that's part of it as well. But it seems like they should have been giving the ball to Tate more and Forsett more and Foster even more and done a less of the passing and let Schaub just throw 26, 27 times rather than 37 to 40. Did that change the attitude and the mentality of this offense? It just seems to me like when they were pounding the ball, they looked great. And it seems like they're a little bit soft and Schaub really kind of was almost given the reins in the second half, and that's when the wheels fall off. Am I wrong in this, or is that part of it? Run blocking and pass blocking, it's a different mentality. Did they lose a little bit of that physicality and that mindset after that Jags game? Or, I mean, why did they all of a sudden seem to drastically change starting with that game?
I think that part of the reason why the offense is kind of falling down is that you kind of touched on that. Arian Foster carried too much of a load this regular season. Once Ben Tate went out and Tate missed just about half the season, a lot of that running game fell on him. Now, yeah, credit Justin Forsett. Was a fairly effective change of pace back, and he had his moments, but they were at their best when you had both Tate and Foster at 100%. You know, Foster, and it showed, the last few weeks. He's a guy, he's taken a bit of a load. He's not been as effective a running back as, he usually has been, over the course of the last three seasons. But you also have to take a look at the fact that once they got exposed to Jacksonville, teams were able to just look at that game plan and kind of figure that, hey, this is how we stop the Texans. This is how you can do this. Because their secondary, Jonathan Joseph, got to the Pro Bowl, but at the same time, he was not the Jonathan Joseph that he was last season. And obviously it was a big difference with the injury that he had. But I really think the problem with the Texans right now is, again, the fact that they were extremely overrated this season. I think that we all got caught up in the fact that, yeah, they were a trendy Super Bowl pick. They lived up to the expectations. Even though they got trounced by Green Bay in Week 6, everybody kind of thought it was an aberration and that, it was a preview of the Super Bowl. So I think that game really started showing signs, and I think that a lot of people were blind to that fact. And now, looking at this team, I think the reality is that, this is a franchise that, really is sort of becoming, to a certain extent, San Diego. And the fact that there's a lot of talent across the board, but for some reason or another, they can't put it together.
All right. Still having some technical difficulties. You still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. We lost you for a second there. Okay. That may be true, and again, it's hard to judge, but they definitely did seem to change a little bit. Obviously, they were extremely disappointing down the stretch. We'll talk about that a little bit more as we talk about the playoffs, because obviously Houston has to play a game next week. Let's talk a little bit here. One more team I want to talk about is Indianapolis and Chuck Pagano. What did you see them? Were they playing inspired football yesterday? Because Indy really gained nothing by that win. Other than A, confidence, and maybe more than any team, other than maybe Minnesota, I suppose, because after they go, they put a victory together against Green Bay. Other than them, Indianapolis probably did gain some confidence and some chemistry benefits from truly playing hard yesterday. A team like the Falcons, who actually may lose Jonathan Abraham, probably they went out there and played a full set of team. They played their whole team, and yet still suffered negative consequences because of it. But the Colts, I mean, they're kind of the perfect example of why you play everybody in a meaningless game, is that there was actual benefit, I think, to what they played. Going into the playoffs, the Colts have to be the most confident about their team after beating up on the Texans, and they felt all season. And with their coach back and that kind of those two things blended together, that was it turned out to be just you could not diagram it any better. Their head coach comes back from cancer, his first game back. They're playing in a meaningless game, yet they play everybody. It's a division rival. They beat up on them good. They may end up facing them again later. It really couldn't have gone any better for Indianapolis. And it's really the example of why you play everybody in a meaningless game. But were you impressed by Indy yesterday, or was it more disappointed by the Texans? And do you think the Colts could win an opening week game? Because I don't think the Colts are actually a very good team. I think they benefited from a very mediocre schedule, and they do have some very talented players, I think, learning and making some mistakes, but talented nonetheless. What did you see in that game? And did you think they really were inspired by Pagano coming back, or is the media overplaying that a little bit?
I think for once the media is right. I think that having Pagano back just really inspired him. He was always a presence, during, his illness. Players would get a chance to visit him. He'd make his way around the facilities. But having him back on the field, having him on the sidelines, having him as the head coach really galvanized this team. And you're right also the fact that,
Yeah, granted, they had nothing to gain from playing their starters or anything like that, but I think it was a good thing in the fact that they were able to gain a certain level of confidence that they'll go into Baltimore with. Now, I don't think that they'll beat the Ravens in that, and you're right. This is a team that benefited off of a very weak schedule, but they also played into the fact that they were playing for their coach. That really had a lot to do with it. You know, they played a lot of emotion, and we touched on a little bit about this last week, about the fact that, you know, sometimes the emotions can't really be a driving force. It could be the thing that could put a team together. You know, they see their coach that's sick, and they're thinking that, you know, he's fighting this illness with everything he has. So us being down 7 with under 2 minutes to go, the ball on our 10-yard line at one timeout, that's nothing compared to what he's doing. We can do this. And I think they kind of fed on that as well. You got to crawl before you got to walk before you got to crawl before you walk in the National Football League. And yeah, I think that they will lose to the Colts on Sunday. But again, the foundation set for them to improve. And having Pagano back for a full season, also another fact that a lot of people may not realize, they got $43 million under the salary cap. So that means that they've got an opportunity to really improve that franchise during the offseason as well.
Yeah, there's a lot going in the right direction with the Colts. I'm not sure I'm a huge Vic Ballard fan, but he's at least sufficient. Let's put him that way. They need a better running game, but he showed some signs of at least being usable. You'd like to have a guy who maybe performed closer to Alfred Morris than Vic Ballard, but nonetheless, they've got a lot of things going in the right direction. It'll be interesting to see if they can win fast enough to still take advantage of Reggie Wayne, because he is getting older, and he had a great season this year. But are they a Super Bowl contender in 2014 or 2015 rather than 2013? That'll be the question, and we'll get into that a lot more in the following week. That's pretty much the news and notes there. Anyone out there who'd like to call into the show, you can reach us at 619-639-4706. Again, if you'd like to call into the show, we're here every Monday night from 7 to 9 Eastern. And that number is 619-639-4706. We're coming to you here on New Year's Eve. I hope everyone has a happy New Year celebration. Everybody drive safe. Hopefully everyone had a fantastic Christmas. We didn't tell you that early in the show, but we're getting to it here. Hopefully everyone had a fantastic Christmas, and we're glad that everyone's been tuning in. Hopefully you caught last week's show on download. It was a Christmas Eve show, so we didn't expect you to listen live. But hopefully you were able to listen downloading us on Blog Talk Radio. That's where you can find us. You'll probably end up downloading this show as well, unless you'd like to talk, drink a few beers, and sit around the New Year's Eve party. And hopefully, if you're doing that, fantastic. But again, if you want to call on the show, you can get us at 619-639-4706. He's Brandon Williams. I'm Chris Mitchell. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, it's at CJMitch73. If you'd like to follow Brandon, you can get him at BCWilliams71 on Twitter or Brandon C. Williams on Facebook. We're talking everything NFL like we do every single week. We just finished talking about some of the disappointments of the week in Week 17. Let's get to Black Monday a little bit here, the coaches that were fired. Coaches and GMs, all no one got spared here this week from bloody Black Monday. Let's go a little bit over some of the coaches and GMs that have gone or were able to stay put. Obviously, Andy Reid gone in Philly. Romeo Crennel gone in Kansas City. Scott Pioli, it looks like he's going to keep his job there. It looks like he's going to get one opportunity, and he's going to have some tough decisions to make. He's going to have, if I'm not mistaken, we'll talk about this a little bit more, I believe the Chiefs have the number one overall pick, and it's a little bit disappointing or a little bit unfortunate for Pioli, because that's going to be a gigantic pick for him to make. And yet there is no RG3 or Andrew Luck or Adrian Peterson, really, in the draft. So he's going to have an extremely important pick to his career. If he makes some bad picks there or makes a bad trade, his job security could very much be gone, as he's already shaky. So he's got to bring in a coach. He's got to bring in a quarterback. He's got to bring in some teams that get them respectable. And right now, that number one pick is looking about as it's probably one of the lower value number one picks we've seen in a while based on who's out there in the college ranks to draft. But we'll see what he's able to do there. Pat Shurmur and GM Heckert in Cleveland, both gone. We'll talk about him as well. I understand why they're gone. Pat Shermer, I thought, did a decent job there, but we'll talk about that a little bit. One of the more surprising dismissals was Lovie Smith in Chicago. It doesn't shock me that he's gone because he has a winning record, and usually winning records get guys at least an extra season. But nonetheless, the Bears, with what looks like on the field, the talent it looks like they have, it looks like they've been disappointing in not being legitimate Super Bowl contenders more consistently. And he's missed the playoffs. I believe I read 5 out of the last 6 seasons. So for a team that, even though they keep having winning records, to have that kind of stretch, it's not a shocker that he'd be gone, but it is a bit of a surprise. I think most people thought he would get another season, and he didn't. GM Tannenbaum in New York is gone, but Rex Ryan is staying. I actually agree with that decision, and we'll get into that as well. Right now, Ron Rivera, it looks like he's probably out, but at the moment, at least, he isn't. Ken Whisenhunt, coming into the morning, it looked like it was up in the air. We didn't know what was going on there. You've announced that just recently he is gone in Arizona. I don't know if he's to blame or not, but the fact is he's the head coach, and he didn't get those quarterbacks successful there, and obviously they were an embarrassment in the NFL this season. So when you're that bad, it doesn't surprise you that the guy would be gone. Chan Gailey, an odd signing in Buffalo to begin with, he's gone. North Turner and GM A.J. Smith both gone in San Diego. I think that's the right call. I thought North Turner should have been gone half a decade ago. A.J. Smith deserves to be gone because he kept North Turner around so long. So those guys are both gone in San Diego. Oakland's offensive coordinator, Greg Knapp, is gone. He is known for the zone blocking scheme there, and it seems like that was a complete and utter failure. So he's gone, but it looks like the head coach, Dennis Allen, is going to stay in Oakland, at least for now. That's an interesting one. It looks like Mike Mularkey's okay in Jacksonville. They kind of played reasonably well in the second half, and the kind of debacle that went on there with Maurice Jones-Drew, can't really blame Mularkey for that, I don't think. Maybe he deserves to come back. It'll be interesting to see what happens there. He may be a lame duck anyway. They're going to bring in Tim Tebow. I can't see how Mularkey will be happy about that. It looks like, though, the owner wants that in there. It almost seems like they want to see what they get with Tebow a full season. Mularkey can kind of be the figurehead there, and then when they fail, then he can get rid of him and bring in someone new. Maybe that's what's being going on there. Maybe Mularkey should resign at this point. Maybe that's the move he should do. But nonetheless, it looks like he's going to keep his job at least for the next season. And Schwartz in Detroit is staying as well. There was some speculation that he could go. And let's start with that. Should Jim Schwartz in Detroit be gone? It looks like he's got an extension through, 2015. It seems like that's a significant reason why he's staying. Detroit's been very loyal to coaches there. I remember Wayne Font stayed probably 4 or 5 years longer than he should have back in the day. So the Fords don't like to make a lot of moves. They like stability there. And that's probably played a large part of why he's staying as well. But nonetheless, Jim Schwartz, you think performance on the field, expectations, should he be gone? Or does he deserve at least another opportunity?
I think he deserves another opportunity. I think that, you know, you have to give credit to the Fords for not pulling a quick trigger, you know, when a lot of people would have expected. And I think at the start of the season, a lot of people felt that this Lions team, as good as they were last year, had significant flaws, and that it would be an uphill climb for them to duplicate what they did in 2011. I think the big problem was that nobody expected them to go 4-12 this season. They had injuries across the board, and that defense really wasn't that good to begin with. And, you know, those things really contributed to that. You know, they're going to have a top-10 pick in the draft, so it's going to allow them to address, you know, myriad number of needs, you know, on the defensive side of the ball. You know, maybe they, you know, look at a cornerback or maybe another pass rusher, you know, to help enhance that defense. You know, for the most part, what you're going to get with them offensively. You know, you're going to get Matt Stafford. You're going to get Megatron. They got hit with injuries at the receiving corps all year long. And, you know, and it's a tribute to Megatron that he was able to pick up that many yards, or approach 2,000 yards receiving, despite the fact that they had no one around him for the most part. At the end of the day, I think it's a good move. I think that you have to be able to commit to a coach. And, yeah, you know, there's going to be a stumble here and there. And no matter how bad the stumble, I think that you have to give the guy another shot. And, again, you have to take your hat off to the Fords for giving him another chance. Yeah, he's probably going to be on a short leash going into next season. But at the same time, I think that, you know, it's good that he's there because you need continuity.
Now, what about Mike Mularkey in Jacksonville? Looks like he's going to stay. And I don't know if he deserves to be there, but it looks like that team is in such flux. And I don't even think – I almost think they need another season just to figure out where they should go for the future. So it almost seems like next year is a dead year where they still get themselves organized. If they could come in and just clean out everything and start from scratch, maybe that would be a situation where they would start over from scratch. But it almost seems like they're just so lost at sea right now. They just need to stop spinning so they can figure out where the hell they should set their direction to go. It seems like that's why Mularkey would stay around. If they knew where they wanted to go already, he'd probably be gone. That's my interpretation. What's yours?
I think that, yeah, the Jaguars at times, particularly in the second half, were much more competitive than they were during the first 8 games of the year. And there are some tools that you can build around on that team. You know, you look at a guy like a Justin Blackman, who's going to be an outstanding wide receiver. But you're right. You know, it, for the most part, you know, the Maurice Jones-Drew issue was really a big letdown. And, you know, they went, you know, obviously tried to commit with Blaine Gabbert at the start of the year, but once he got fired, you know, Chad Henne came in, and he looked, you know, fairly effective for the most part at times. But you're right in the sense that, you know, this is a team that has no direction. They're a rudderless ship right now. You know, at 2-14, they're going to have the second overall pick in a draft. And this is an opportunity for them to perhaps maybe trade that draft out and get picks, because like Kansas City, they've got a number of needs across the board that one pick really is not going to solve. So, obviously, they're going to bring in Tim Tebow. I think it's more of let's get the fans excited about something kind of move. And, you know, granted, you know, Heckert might not be, not Heckert, but Mularkey might not be ready for that. You know, it could be the similar situation that team faced in New York last year. But at the same time, I think Mularkey is one of those guys who will accept it is what it is, because basically he's going to be a lame duck coach. You know, and it would be a shock that he remains beyond this season. But again, you know, you look at this franchise, you know, Ishmael Cotton wants to get this franchise back. He wants to try to, you know, get fans excited about the Jags. That's going to be an uphill climb, and he's got to do any and everything possible within himself to be able to do that. You know, Tebow, it's a step more publicity, if anything, but you've got to be able to get fans excited. You know, this is probably, you know, the worst football city in the National Football League right now. You know, they barely draw much of anything. Many of their home games are blacked out, and there just really is no spark or excitement about that team. So you've got to be able to look wherever you can to try to build some level of excitement and try to get people's appetite wet on the fact that, you know, maybe we're going to get better down the road. Just be a little patient.
Yeah, there's a lot not going right there. It seems like they need to clean house, and maybe Mularkey's going to hold the fort until they figure out what they need to do there. San Diego, it looks like they kind of, to me, they made decisions through indecision. A.J. Smith kept North Turner for probably 2 or 3 years too long. Phillip Rivers looks like he's still a decent quarterback, but he looks like he's a guy that needs to move to like an Arizona where they've got a lot of pieces and they need that final piece. Seems like he's not the guy to get San Diego back from where they are to a contender. And maybe a couple years ago he still could have been that cornerstone guy. Now it seems like he needs to be a supplemental choice, and that team just doesn't have it. To me, San Diego they lucked into Denari Alexander. That was a nice kind of luck, but Gates is now beyond his prime. Rivers is kind of falling behind. They've lost a couple of those defensive players that were really good a few years back. Seems like they should have made a significant change for a legitimate coach 2 or 3 years ago, and instead they stuck with North Turner, and that's A.J. Smith's problem, but it's also the ownership problem because they let them just kind of make decisions by not deciding, and it seems like they're in a really bad place. I don't think San Diego can turn this around quickly. I don't think they can add enough because Ryan Matthews – interesting choice, but the guy can't stay healthy, and so it's almost like he's a lost pick at this point. I don't see a lot in San Diego where it looks like they have some talent, but it looks like they just don't have anywhere near enough where they can be considered a legitimate contender. You're hearing guys like Andy Reid or maybe Gruden, which I don't think he'll leave ESPN considering the pressure that ESPN has catered to him so much at this point. I can't imagine him just dumping them. That would be a gigantic cluster of a mess if he did that. But it sounds like a lot of big-time names are rumored to at least be under consideration for that job, as if it's a great job, which I don't know if it is. But who do you think could go there and make San Diego a contender again? Because they're not as much of a mess as, say, a Jacksonville, but it almost seems like they kind of need to do the same thing. It almost seems like they should just clean house and start from scratch, because the people that are there now, I just think they're on the decline, and they're going to keep declining as you're trying to get better. They really seem to be in almost a worse spot than Jacksonville. Everyone knows Jacksonville's a mess. You expectations are so low there. Seems like San Diego, they still have some expectations of contending, and I don't think they really should. I mean, and trades in the NFL don't happen. So they can't trade Ryan Matthews or Phillip Rivers and get young players in there that can build to the future. That's not how the NFL works. That's Major League Baseball. Just in the NFL, you can't do that. It really seems like San Diego's in a really bad spot. Wouldn't Andy Reid want to go there? I don't know. It doesn't seem like a very appealing job to me.
It's not an appealing job. You know, you mentioned the fact that, you know, Jacksonville's a bad situation. The Chargers really aren't that far behind. You know, you mentioned the fact that, you know, Antonio Gates is on the downside of his career. You know, it looks like Phillip Rivers' peak has come and gone. You know, it looks like Ryan Matthews, you know, being talented back that he is when healthy, heavy emphasis on those last, you know, the words when healthy, you know, is not the fact that they envisioned when they drafted him 12th overall 3 years ago. He's not that guy. I think the problem with the Chargers is that, you know, this is a team that needs to be gutted from the, you know, from the bottom up. And it would be very weird for a guy like an Andy Reid to want to try something like that. If I'm the Chargers, I would look to try to find a young coach. I try to look to find a young guy, a first-time head coach, and get him the opportunity. I think a guy that would probably be a good fit out there in San Diego, maybe Dirk Cutter, the Falcons offensive coordinator. He looks like he could possibly be a, you know, a good opportunity for him. Or if you're looking for somebody that, you know, try to go out the box, maybe you give Todd Haley another opportunity. You know, I mean, who knows, depending on his situation in Pittsburgh. But the bottom line with San Diego is that it's an outright mess. It's a downright mess at this point, and I really can't envision seeing, you know, a guy like an Andy Reid doing that. You know, you touched on John Gruden for a second. I don't think Gruden goes anywhere. Like you said, ESPN has done wonders for him. They have catered to him, you know, any and every win that he has gotten from ESPN. He has had that delivered to him. And it would be a shock to me if he took any job in the National Football League this offseason. Because you talk about guys with a cushy job and making seven figures doing it, John Gruden is like the object lesson to that.
Yeah. Other than the charity situations like a Dan Marino, who shouldn't even be on TV at all, I consider that salary a downright charitable association. Other than something like that, Gruden has one of the best situations going. They do completely cater to him. He is a complete and total NFL guru there. He is the genius of NFL on that in that organization, ESPN, it seems like. And Monday Night Football is a gigantic coup. And that's really one of the gems that they have. And they were willing to give up the Sunday night highlight show. They were willing to give that up in order to get the Monday Night show. And that Sunday Night show was a great show. So Monday Night is a huge thing for them. And yes, I agree. I can't see how Gruden would leave that. And they're just total. I mean, they got rid of Jaws in the booth because he was A, in the way. And my guess is he didn't get along that well with Gruden. And so they're doing that all because of Gruden. I can't imagine him leaving either. Chan Gailey in Buffalo. I'm a little bit of a fan of Gailey in that I kind of like him as a person. The little that I know, I don't know him, but I'm a little bit of a fan. But I don't think he's a good head coach. But my question to you is, Buffalo, they have a money problem. They're not a wealthy team. They're one of the smaller markets in the NFL. They do struggle to make money there. That's why they play these games in Canada. But the ownership there is great. The fans there are great. And they really look like they could be a great team with just a couple minor changes. It seems like, other than the fact that they struggle income-wise, Buffalo looks like it really could be a great job. I mean, again, the fans love – Buffalo fans are as avid and as loyal as almost any fans out there. They're just as avid and just as loyal as Pittsburgh and those kinds of places who are football bastions. And they've spent money, and they've got talent, a lot of talent. I mean, really, if you look at it, other than the quarterback position, defensively and offensively, they've got about as much or more talent than even the Patriots. Again, they don't have Tom Brady, and that, at the end of the day, that kind of swings the pendulum there. But that's a team that it seems like, along with the organization, that should be a job that someone should really, really want. But my question is, these additions that they did on the defensive side, were those mistakes, or was that Chan Gailey not being able to properly coach his team? Because on paper, at least, and by names, it looks like this team should be able to, at the very least, compete in the AFC. If not, I mean, if you had an Andy Reid at his best, it seems like Buffalo could be a legitimate Super Bowl contender with the talent they have on the field. if they could get a better quarterback. Is the Buffalo job as good as I'm making it out to be, or is it? I mean, is it just a kind of? Is it not? Is it a bad job? Because it seems like maybe if Andy Reid wants to start from scratch again somewhere, it seems like that'd be a pretty good starting point. Of all the empty jobs now, it seems like Buffalo would give somebody the best opportunity to really do something and be a contender right away.
I honestly feel that Buffalo is the one spot that Andy Reid would be a perfect fit because, again, you look at the talent that they have. You know, C.J. Spiller, Fred Jackson, and Stevie Johnson, you know, Donald Jones. When you know, you look at the defensive line, you know, you've got Marcell Dareus. You know, you've got, Williams. You've got Mario Williams. You know, you've got a lot of talent across the board on that franchise. And this is a franchise, you know, that really isn't as far off as the eye may think. You look at this franchise, and again, the Bills fans, like you said, are a very, very loyal bunch. But unfortunately, you know, the money problems, you know, are really becoming a hamstring to them. They went out and made big ticket signings with the hopes that maybe it would turn things around. Unfortunately, it hasn't as of yet. I think to me, an ideal fit for Buffalo would be Andy Reid and perhaps bringing in Michael Vick, because I think Vick would be a good fit with the explosive skill position players that they have. You know, it's kind of a high-risk, high-reward thing with Vick, but I think it would be a very good fit. If you put those two together, you're looking at a team that can sneak into the wild card next season, in my opinion.
Now, I don't know if Vick can ever be a good fit anywhere. Again, I have doubts that he can achieve greatness for an organization just because of his, again, like I said before, his inability to throw. I wonder about that. But let's just throw out a hypothetical. Let's say somehow they got Peyton Manning rather than Denver. You've got Johnson, Spiller, Jackson, Chandler, tight end isn't bad. He's a decent tight end, but probably better than what Denver has right now. Could a Peyton Manning with an Andy Reid made this team a Super Bowl contender like it looks like Peyton Manning has made Denver? Are they that one guy away? Are they that close or not? I guess that's the question. How close are they? Because I mean, if they added Andy Reid and then traded or got Phillip Rivers, I mean, could Buffalo be a contender, or are they further away than that? Because at least on offense, and then you add Mario Williams, they look like they have some very interesting pieces. But are they that close or not, I guess, is my question.
I think they are close. And, you know, you hit on the point, you know, the quarterback position, you know, is the be-all, end-all in the National Football League. And then they show it with the Bills. Is that, you know, Ryan Fitzpatrick, you know, is a solid, you know, he's solid, you know, above average quarterback, but, you know, he's too erratic. You know, and you don't know what the hell you're going to get out of the kid. One week he's going to throw for 300 yards and three touchdowns. The next week he'll throw for 400 yards and get picked off four times. That's the kind of thing that you're looking at. But, yeah, if you were to pair an Andy Reid with a Phillip Rivers or maybe even Alex Smith, you know, and a quarterback like that, you know, and it would definitely change the complexion of that franchise. Because the Bills, you know, they kept shooting themselves in the foot with mistakes, you know, especially on the offensive side of the ball. It took a little while for their defense to finally gel. But when they did, you know, and we started seeing hints as to how good that defense can be. Again, they're going to have a high draft pick, you know, going into the draft this April. And again, it's an opportunity for them to, depending on the coach that they bring in, improve that team, you know, immensely. Again, you know, and the talent is there for them to make a push for a playoff spot next year. And who's to say that they may not be, you know, next year's Colts? Because you got to remember, it's like, you know, there's a streak of about, say, 10 or 12 years in a row where a team that lost 10 games the previous year ends up going to the playoffs with 10 or more wins. And if you look at, you know, the teams that lost, you know, the teams that missed the playoffs, the teams that have the best chance of returning to the Super Bowl, especially in the top 10 of the draft, I think Buffalo's at one team that could really make a big step forward next year.
Another team that I think fits into that, and it looks like maybe, and I don't know if they could have got something done or not, but Arizona looks like a team that they were primed to really put themselves in a great position in 2012, and they screwed it up. And they could have done two different things, and I think they could have been an elite team. A, if they had done what Washington did and trade up so they could get RG3. If Arizona had RG3 with Larry Fitzgerald and that defense, they could be better than what Washington is right now, other than the running game. I guess we could debate how valuable Alfred Morris is. RG3 with Morris, are they that big of the difference is Morris that valuable to why Washington is so good? Because really, he would have better pieces in Arizona with RG3 than RG3 has in Washington, except for Morris. So my question is, if Arizona had gone out and spent whatever they had to get RG3 in the draft, or if they had spent whatever they had to get Peyton Manning there, would Arizona be a Super Bowl contender right now? And if you agree that they're that close, A, should they have gotten rid of Wisenhunt last year? I mean, for example, imagine if Andy Reid or someone like him was available on the market as a coach last year. If Arizona had put that kind of guy with that kind of credibility in that position, could they have won the sweepstakes for Manning and got him to go there rather than Denver? I mean, it seems like Arizona is that close. Their defense, at least against the passing game, looks so strong. It looks like Arizona is extremely close to being a great job and possibly a team that could be very good for a long time. Were they that close in 2012 and they blew it? Or did their defense show some things, but they're really not that good? Because it really seems like they had a great opportunity if a GM did something really smart there and they blew it. To me, that's what we see and what they performed this year. If they had fired Ken Wisenhunt and brought in someone with true credibility, could Arizona be what Washington is now, or am I kind of exaggerating here?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, you make a good point. Because other than Mark Sanchez, there is no team in the NFL that suffered from more pathetic quarterback play than the Arizona Cardinals. You know, they got to the point where you're kind of hoping that Neil Lomax would come out of retirement and perhaps he'll line up under center. Jim Hart, anybody would have been better than what they had at quarterback this year. Andy Reid in Arizona is also intriguing as well, but again, you know, it comes down to the fact that does he want to go to Arizona, knowing the fact that he's going to be hobbled with Kevin Cobb? You know, they got rid of Cobb 2 years ago, you know, in order to, you know, open the door and really set things up for Michael Vick to be the starter there. I don't think Cobb's an NFL quarterback, not by any stretch of the imagination at this point, and I don't think Reid would want to go back into something like that. Now, if they were to get rid of him and you bring in a guy like maybe an Alex Smith or, hell, even a Michael Vick in that scenario, this is a team that's going to get better. Their defense is solid. You know, they are suspect against the run at times, but their pass defense is one of the best in the NFL. You know, you've got talent. You know, Larry Fitzgerald is still one of the two or three best wide receivers in the game. You know, you've got guys like Patrick Peterson, you know, as part of that defense. And you look at this, you know, Adrian Wilson as well in the secondary. You look at a team like that, and you get a sense that, you know, they're not that far off. You know, you saw how good they were when they jumped out to a 4-0 start with their defense. You know, you can imagine how good this team could have been had they had some semblance of quarterback. At quarterback, you know, hell, average play at quarterback. You know, you give them an average quarterback, you know, say like an Alex Smith or say, you know, someone along those lines, you know, in the end, they probably would have been a little more competitive. You know, I think that, yes, you're right in the belief that if you give them a quarterback along with a competent coach, a coach that can command respect and change the complexion of that franchise, this is, again, another one of those teams that could rise up and do what Indianapolis did last year, which is take advantage of a weak schedule and surprise people and make the postseason.
Yeah, I think they're a situation where a good GM and a good coach, specifically a GM in their case, or ownership in general, that's where an organization matters. I think Bob Kraft, he saw what he needed. He went out and got it done. Because remember, Bill Belichick was going to go to the Jets. And then when New England came in and they kind of swooped in and they finally said, look, Belichick's the guy we want and we're going to do whatever we have to. And they paid a pretty lofty price to steal Belichick away from the Jets. Because there was a point, it's almost like Bill Belichick was like 20 minutes away from being announced as the coach of the Jets. You know, the Krafts went in, they zoomed in and said, look, I know you're about to sign the line, but don't do it, we want you. I mean, that's the kind of decisiveness you need sometimes. And it seems like if Arizona had that, they could be heading in the right direction as a really strong organization, and it seems like that indecision maybe or that lack of doing whatever you have to do at that one precise moment, it seems like they kind of blew it because this has been a really disastrous season for them. And if they had Manning or they had RG3, imagine how Arizona would look if they had RG3 there right now. Just imagine with Larry Fitzgerald and how well the defense played this year, especially against the pass, that organization would look extremely appealing rather than kind of a laughing stock. And it's all based down to they just had to do what they needed to do at the quarterback position. and they just didn't do what they had to do, and they lost out. They didn't make the trade. They didn't trade up, and they didn't sign Peyton. And those are two opportunities. Now, maybe Peyton was never going to go there, and if that's the case, then I'm wrong. But it seems like there was an argument for Arizona to make there, and it seems like that's an argument they should have been able to make to at least legitimately have that as an option, and they didn't. So it seems like that was a lost opportunity. Looks like Ron Rivera is going to be out in Carolina. Not a lot to love in Carolina, but they've got one thing that I guess you really have to love, and that's Cam Newton. Is he so good, and is it so important, and I think it is, I'm asking kind of a rhetorical question here, but is the quarterback position, to have a guy as talented as Cam Newton, they're so important that Cam Newton and Cam Newton alone makes a Carolina job a job that a lot of guys might want? Is that an appealing job because of Cam Newton?
Oh, in a word, yes, and in two words, hell yes, it's an appealing job because of Newton. And he is a guy that, especially in the last 5 or 6 weeks of the season, he showed a lot of improvement. He had the streak earlier in the season where there were questions about his maturity or whether or not he's going to be a punk or whatever, something like that. But he ended up, turning things around, and he was quietly one of the more effective quarterbacks in the NFL over the last month and a half. Word is that if Rivera is officially done, the job is going to be Chip Kelly, the Oregon coach, to lose. And it's got to be intriguing, to have Chip Kelly in that style of offense and to have a quarterback like Cam Newton running that offense. There's a little bit of talent there. And Steve Smith is falling in the cloud. He's probably got a couple more years left, but he's still an effective wide receiver. Brandon LaFell is a guy that we both like, and still hope that, can really turn it around and tap into that potential. There's some talent there. I know that neither one of us are really sold on the backs, Williams and or Stewart. But Cam Newton alone makes that such an intriguing job that, you would just be tempted. If you're a coach looking at interviewing for that position, you've got to be tempted. You've got to think that, what I can do to build this franchise around Cam Newton. What could I do to improve that offense? What can I do to make Cam Newton even better? Because, again, Cam Newton to me is a guy who's only beginning to scratch the surface of his potential. And it's scary to think that a guy 6'5", 248 pounds, and runs 4'4", legitimate 4'4", in the 40 can do once the light really comes on with his potential. Now, it might take a year or two, but if you get the right coach in there who harnesses him, and you let management, you let ownership give this guy a certain amount of leeway, maybe 2 or 3 years to get his act together, I promise you it would pay off in an NFC championship game. I honestly think Cam Newton's going to be a quarterback that's going to win multiple Super Bowls before it's all said and done.
I wonder if Chip Kelly would be a good fit there, though. It seems like a Drew Brees or a Tom Brady, those guys who make quick decisions, can throw the quick screens or the slants. It seems like those are the types of quarterbacks you'd want at a Chip Kelly type of offense, where it seems like Newton you'd want like he had last year with Smith having another breakout year. It seems like you'd want a good receiver in a slow, standard type of offense where he can throw downfield. And it doesn't seem like a quick snap decision and slant type of offense is the kind that Cam Newton would thrive in best. It doesn't strike me as that. Am I wrong in your opinion? It just seems like he's more of a drop-back guy. He runs some. It seems like the high-flying, fast, quick decision-making, really five-wide, spread-out situation doesn't strike me as that really plays into Newton's best strengths. Am I wrong there, or it doesn't seem like a perfect fit to me?
It doesn't seem like that good of a fit, because to me, if Chip Kelly's going to jump from Oregon, and depending on what sanctions might hit them during the offseason, that's a potential factor in him jumping. But if Chip Kelly's going to jump to the National Football League, I think Philadelphia is the best place for him because he's already got the skill position players in place to run the style of offense that he has. You've got a Shady McCoy who could be a little Michael James for him, and you've got Bryce Brown, and Brandon Brown had up and down performance once he started getting touches late in the season. But he could be the LeGarrette Blount type kind of guy. No one doubts the potential of DeSean Jackson and Macklin, then no one disputes that. You've got Brent Celek at tight end. There's a lot of talent at the skill position, but I think the big problem with Philadelphia, especially on the offensive side of the ball, were the injuries on the offensive line. Jason Peter got injured during minicamp, and it just kind of went downhill from there. And if you can get this Eagles team, and if Kelly goes there, and you give him a strong offensive line you know, and the talent is there, you know, if it's healthy. You give him that. I think this Eagles team could be very, very exciting, not just, you know, for, you know, fans, but I think it's the kind of team that, you know, that could really help change the complexity of the NFL style offense that Kelly would bring.
Yeah, I almost feel like you said, I think Nick Foles would actually be a better fit to a Kelly than a Cam Newton. And I don't think Nick Foles is anywhere near the quarterback that Cam Newton is.
No,
it seems like his style would fit a little bit better.
No, you're right. You know, he would fit the offense a little better. Oh, you know, Foles is, you know, he's not, you know, a statue in the matter of a Matt Schaub. You know, granted, he's not RG3, but the guy is a little more mobile than he's given credit for. He's got the big arm, and he's also got, you know, the ability to make those short intermediate passes. He's played a little bit of the sprint before at Arizona State, and he's able to make those quick decisions. And you look at a lot of what the Eagles ran over the past 2 or 3 years. They ran variations of the spread. They ran a lot of receiver screens, you know, things along those lines. You know, they kind of looked, when they were clicking in 2010, they kind of looked like a college team with the way that they were able to move the ball downfield, especially when Reed decided to let Vic spread the ball out and move the ball downfield. So, you know, the talent is there in Philadelphia. You know, and I guess we could probably segue into that. But, you know, the talent is certainly there in Philadelphia. No one questions that. I just think that this was a team that, you know, had a lot, that just had a lot of misfit toys. You know, guys like Anami Asamoah, you know, for example. You had a lot, you know, Jason Bateman to a certain extent. I think you had a lot of talent there, but at the same time, you know, this franchise, I think, really became stale when it came to responding to Andy Reid. You know, in Reid, 14 years, you know, and that's forever as an NFL coach these days. No one's ever going to be a Tom Landry type. You know, no, that's not going to happen ever. But I do think that with a fresh start, a lot of those guys are going to be revived in Philadelphia. And if you get a guy like that, Chip Kelly, a guy who's got an imaginative offense, a guy, you know, that's going to come in and get the city sparked up and get that franchise sparked up again, I think that's going to be a benefit to those players, especially the ones who really weren't responding to Reid over the last 2 or 3 seasons.
Yeah, there's definitely some potential in Philly, and it does seem like that would be the perfect fit for Kelly. And it just doesn't seem like Vic is the right fit there. But I think Kelly with that, and there's a lot of talent on that Philadelphia, at least on the offensive side. And if you utilize it properly, I wonder what you need to do to utilize it perfectly. But it looks like Kelly is the right fit. We'll see if that ends up being the case. But it looks like it that would be a good fit. Moving over now to the Jets. Looks like Rex Ryan's keeping his job. It looks like GM Tannenbaum is gone. I actually think that's the right decision. As much as I'm annoyed by Rex Ryan and his arrogance, the fact is I do think he's a very good defensive coach. And overall, I think he's a very good coach. It seems like when things are going the right way, and he's not being this stubborn, pig-headed jerk, essentially, which is what he became with the Tebow Sanchez situation, it seems like I think Rex Ryan is a competitive coach. I think he's too pig-headed and too stubborn to win a Super Bowl. So if he was given an elite quarterback, I think he'd screw it up, to be quite honest. But what you saw when Sanchez first came into the league is he played really good defense, he ran the ball, played power football, and when Sanchez wasn't making huge amounts of mistakes, there were some games, even when they were winning, where Sanchez was losing games on his own. That was always going to happen because Sanchez just isn't a good quarterback. But nonetheless, I think Rex Ryan, when he's playing conservative, sound power football on both sides, he's a good coach. Not a great coach, but a good coach. So I think keeping him isn't a bad decision. Tannenbaum, I definitely think, needed to go. Obviously, the talent level there is miserable. Now, that being said, I'm not so sure the talent wasn't there enough. If Revis stayed healthy, if they didn't have Tebow and all the mess that created, and I really do think that the Tebow mess contributed to why Mark Sanchez was so bad this year. His regression, I think, had something to do with Tebow being there. I can't say why, because I can't say Tebow being here is A, and therefore because of that it caused B. I can't make that correlation, but I can't understand any reason why Sanchez went from being a bad quarterback but still a quarterback that won to being a dismally just horrible quarterback this year. And I'm not ready to say that he was worse than Arizona. I think Arizona's quarterbacks were worse, but Sanchez was at least in the running. I mean, Arizona had 3 or 4 guys trying to be that were all bad. Sanchez was single-handedly bad by himself. But to me, that must have had some kind of problem there. There just must have been something going on, and I think part of Rex Ryan's weaknesses played out in how that team ended up this year. And I mean, do you really think the Jets' offense is that much worse now than they were 2 or 3 years ago when they beat the Patriots and got to the AFC final? I mean, their receivers weren't that great then. Granted, they might have been a little bit better, but they're not much. I mean, Braylon Edwards, he was not a good receiver even when he was there. And now that he's gone, he tells me that made the difference in the world. To me, Tannenbaum did a bad job, but I think the distraction in the ownership forcing Tebow on them and them forcing against it by not even using him, it seems like if they had embraced Tebow rather than just making him like a bat, it almost like they drew a line in the sand and Tebow was the line and there was a tug of war back and forth. To me, that was what really killed them more than anything. And then you add the fact that Revis is done for the season. That was just another one that kind of piled on. But if they added a Larry Fitzgerald, I mean, do you think all of a sudden Sanchez becomes a good quarterback? I think that's an excuse without really being an accurate evaluation of what was wrong there. I don't see how their weakness talent-wise significantly different than it was 2 years ago. Do you think it is, or do you think that was a difference maker, or what do you think really went wrong there, and is Tannenbaum truly the guy to blame there?
And Tannenbaum was the guy who brought the talent in, and he deserves full blame. And, you know, and like I said, you know, it's the right call. I think Rex Ryan did deserve at least another season to get things straightened out, whereas Tannenbaum really burned the bridge, you know, especially with the Tebow fiasco. I think another reason why the Jets offense, you know, kind of digressed, you know, not only because of Sanchez, but I think the fact is that, you know, with their style of offense, I think there's a little more room for error, especially when you're behind. You know, it's great when you're able to dictate the pace and you're playing ball control, but, you know, their offense is kind of like a Timex watch in the digital age when you compare the rest of the National Football League and the emphasis on passing. I think that at this point, you know, I don't think that they'll do it, but I think you've got to get rid of Mark Sanchez at this point. I think you've got to cut bait with this kid and give him an opportunity, because bringing him back next season, and it looks like he probably will, he's not going to get any better. His confidence is completely shot. I saw a little bit of that game yesterday. This kid's confidence is shot to hell. And I don't think that bringing him back to New York is going to help him out even more. He's been, you know, he was the whipping boy all season long, and for the most part, deservedly so. But I just think that, you know, the Jets would be better served by moving this kid. I know that it's Rex Ryan's guy. It was his first pick, and yes, I know that he did take them to 2 AFC championship games. But, you know, the NFL's a what have you done for me lately league, and lately this kid has stunk. You know, and I saw a stat where, you know, he had the worst QBR rating, and it's the ESPN thing, and it's a pretty effective way of looking at quarterbacks, to be honest. But he had the worst QBR rating amongst any National Football League quarterback. You know, and on the one hand, you can say there's nowhere to go but up, but he's in New York in an environment, media-wise, that just beats the hell out of the very best of them. And if your confidence is shot, and you're still getting beat up by the press, you know, getting beat up by the fans, now I just think that, you know, the Jets would be doing this kid a favor. It would be doing the franchise a favor by getting him out of there. You know, who would be the quarterback next year? You know, Ian, I don't know. Do you go and draft one? Do you go out and try to find a free agent, move forward, Alex Smith, you know, or whatever? But I just think that, you know, he's got to go. And I don't think this team is going to get any better, even if you did upgrade, you know, the offense. I just don't think that they're going to get any better as long as you've got more Sanchez under center.
Yeah, and the Jets are in I wouldn't say a comparable situation to the Chargers, but in some ways I would say they are, in the sense that I don't think it would take much for them to at least be competitive, because, again, they were right in the playoff hunt pretty deep into this season until they lost to Tennessee in that just kind of punctuation on a continuing embarrassing situation. But until that loss, they were still at least in the hunt for the playoffs. And I think that's kind of more of an indictment on how mediocre the AFC is than anything. But nonetheless, they were in the hunt. And if Mark Sanchez didn't single-handedly lose 4 or 5 games just because he was that bad, all of a sudden the Jets are a competitor, and with New England's defensive issues, all of a sudden the AFC East winning that division doesn't seem completely impossible, though looking at it now, it really does look like the Patriots are by far the maybe the best in the AFC. But nonetheless, at one point with how bad the New England defense was, it almost seemed like the Jets could possibly win the division, as odd as that sounds. So they're close to being competitive. But the problem is, I don't think they're close to being contenders. I think they could make the playoffs or make a push for the playoffs. But could they literally legitimately scare someone into getting to a Super Bowl and even winning that? And I don't think they are. And even if they had a great quarterback, then I think that would emphasize how bad Tannenbaum really has been. Because if they had a great quarterback like a Peyton Manning, that's where you would see how bad the talent is on that squad. But at this point, they can't even take advantage of a great quarterback. And that's where I see the problem is it's so hard for a team to totally tear it all down and start over when you're that close to being competitive. Because in the NFL, you're supposed to win every year. And you see how quickly teams go from 2-14 to 12-4. And so the Jets could easily be 10-6 with just a little bit of a change in the way things are going there. But I don't think they're anywhere near 12-4 or 13-3 and a chance at a Super Bowl. And that's a really difficult position to be. To be consistently competitive, but no real chance to win at all. That's a tough spot to be. And that's where I think the Jets are. If they brought in Larry Fitzgerald and Peyton Manning, okay. Then maybe all of a sudden they are. But it's awful tough to do that. And there's not a Peyton Manning on the market anymore. So that's where I think their problem is. They're two pieces away, and those are two pieces it's really difficult to get. So I don't know what happens there, and I don't know what they do. And it looks like no one's going to trade for Sanchez, so it looks like they're stuck with him, and he'll be more of a distraction. I think you need to cut him just because I think he's more of a distraction than anything else. And if you bring in someone and you try to change direction, if Sanchez is there, then that's going to be the question. You know, he's going to be a backup quarterback, and they say, well, go to Sanchez. I can't imagine fans saying that, but if he's there, fans are going to find something to say that involves Sanchez. I can't even predict what that would be, but he's going to be there somehow. Whether you make a bad throw or you make a bad fumble, oh, he's Sanchez or something. I mean, you're going to see something like that. So it seems like he really has to go, but I don't know how they do that. I don't know how they make the changes that they need to make there, and I don't know. Rex Ryan's in a tough spot. I think Rex Ryan, if he had embraced Tebow and been a better leader, I think this team could look like they're going in the right direction a little bit more. But because he just drew that line in the sand and really just waged war, I think that's really hurt this organization. And that's what I see being a problem with Rex Ryan. I think he's a good coach and probably deserves to be coach. But his stubbornness and his pigheadedness to me is a real problem and his justification for firing him. So I'm kind of torn on that. And I think Tebow was what really did it. I don't know why he drew that line in the sand. Most coaches should be mature enough not to do that. And that's where I see Ryan's problem. And I think that's just going to continue to happen. I don't think he's going to solve that. He's just too stubborn. And I just don't see it. I don't see how it's going to get better there. I think Ryan has to go eventually. But I do think he's a good enough coach where he should still be there. So I think the Jets are going to be in limbo for a couple more seasons, and then we'll see what the heck happens there. Say that again?
I say they're in the land of the damned. You know, when you talk about the fact that, you know, this is a franchise that, you know, is just up in limbo, you know, the proverbial 9-7 to 7-9, where you're either just short of missing the playoffs or you're a one and done in the postseason. You know, you're stuck, you know, in that draft spot between 18 to 22. And, you know, it's something that, you know, you fans will tire of. And, you know, when you're in that situation for an extended period of time, there's a word for that, and it's called mediocrity.
Yeah, I would agree. And that's the thing is, again, I think Rex Ryan is a good coach. It's just he has to have his team the way he has to have it. And that stubbornness this year, I think, really put that in jeopardy. And I don't know if he can go back to being good. And that's really the shame of it. I think Tebow could have done some things for that team if they embraced it and tried to utilize the fact that Tim Tebow is a good football player. He's not a good quarterback. But if you utilize him somehow, if you thought outside the box, which we talked about before, most people don't do, I think having him could have been a benefit. And instead, they just waged war, and everyone dug their heels in, and they totally made the decision, and they just made the situation impossible. And if you're a coach at the elite level, you're supposed to find ways to win, and you're supposed to find ways to utilize assets. And Tebow could have been that, and Rex Ryan clearly showed that he cannot do that. He cannot take in something and utilize it somehow. He just can't. And Rex Ryan is never going to be able to do that. And that's really the problem. And his dad was just like that, too. His dad was a genius, but just a pig-headed, stubborn, bull of a person. And I think that's going to be a problem there. But the Jets situation did not have to be the disaster that it kind of was this year. And we'll see. I agree. I think they're in the dead zone there, but I don't know how they get out of it either. So we'll move on to Cleveland, which is, I guess they're floating in the dead zone. They're outright dead. The coach, Pat Shurmur, is gone there. Obviously, they lost Holmgren early in the year. The current GM, Hecker, is also gone in Cleveland. I don't know what's going on there because I don't know the Cleveland ownership well enough, but I know a little bit about the Cincinnati ownership, and Paul Brown and the Brown family are a disaster in Cincinnati. They have run that team so poorly that it's amazing what Marvin Lewis has been able to do in Cincinnati. And now they may be the best team in the division in the next 2 or 3 years. So somehow Marvin Lewis has done a fantastic job with a miserably bad group of owners in Cincinnati. I mention that because in Cleveland, I don't think that they're known as being that bad, the owners there, but they've obviously done an extremely poor job drafting and hiring coaches and things there. Because that organization, maybe Holmgren's not a good GM, and so maybe that was a bad decision. Maybe he's a great coach and a bad GM. Maybe that's what happened there. But Cleveland fans are great football fans. Cleveland fans are crazy. I mean, they flip-flop in the wind. I mean, you can go literally, not even game-to-game or season-to-season, but play-to-play, series-to-series, where they think Cleveland is the best, and all of a sudden they think their Browns are the worst, in literally less than 15 minutes. That's the kind of weird, crazy way that Cleveland fans are. And it's not just football. Everything. You know, Jim Tomei in his day in Cleveland could hit a home run and be the best in the world. Then he strikes out 2 days in a row and 2 games in a row or 2 at-bats in a row, and all of a sudden they want to get rid of him. I mean, that's the lunacy that is Cleveland fans. But one thing you can't blame them for is they love their teams. They support them 100% or criticize them 100%, whichever way the wind is blowing. But nonetheless, they are passionate and excited and interesting. And that is something that's pretty special. And yet they just can't do what's right in Cleveland. They just screw up time and time again. I've been giving Pat Shurmur credit because Cleveland, for the most part, goes out and competes every single week. And towards the end of the year when the season was kind of winding down and Trent Richardson was getting more and more beat up every single week, they did fall off. But at the end of the day, Cleveland has 5 wins, which it probably would have been better off if they only had 2 so they could have the higher draft pick. But nonetheless, Cleveland didn't win. Being competitive, and I gave Pat Shurmur credit for that over and over and over all year long. At the end of the day, they're 5-11. So it's justification for why both of those guys are gone. But my question is, what could they bring in to turn this around? Because like I said with the fans, if a winning team, a good, legitimate, contending team there, year in and year out, they don't need to win the Super Bowl. They just need to be in the hunt. And that would be a great place for an NFL team to be able to just be competitive. The NFL would be so much better if the lunacy of the Cleveland fans were involved. The dog pound and all the craziness that they had back then. It's a great place for football, but they're just a laughing stock. They're a rug that everyone wipes their shoes on year in and year out. Is there one guy that could be brought in there? Bill Belichick was there one time, and he couldn't win there. So, I mean, what is going wrong there? What do they need to do? Because, again, I like Brandon Whedon. I think they've got some talent. Trent Richardson is clearly a good running back. But what does that team need to do to get back to being competitive? Is there someone out there that's available that could be brought in and bring this organization back to respectability and competitiveness? Because that's what they need there. And for a very long time now, they just can't find it. What do they need to do?
I think they have the guy in Pat Shurmur. I mean, and you look around the Twitterverse, you know, this afternoon, and there are a lot of, you know, Browns players that are basically voicing their frustration about the fact that he was let go. This was a 5-11 team, no question. It was a bad team, but they played competitively almost every week. You know, they were aggressive, you know, and, you know, came, you know, they were probably about maybe 2 or 3 plays away from being an 8-8 club. You know, Trent Richardson is going to be elite running back. You've got Brandon Wheaton, who I think is going to be, you know, a competent, above-average quarterback. You know, their defense, you know, struggling at times, but, you know, they were getting better. They were starting to become the identity. They were becoming the identity of what Pat Shurmur was all about. And now you tear that up, and now you've got to bring in a coach that's going to basically start from scratch.
And I don't know who you bring in there. You know, because, again, we don't know the ownership that well to have a good read as to who would be a good fit. Could you say that, you know, do they go for a veteran? Do they go for Andy Reid? Or do they try to bring a Lovie Smith in there? Do they try to bring a first-time head coach in there? You just don't know as to what direction that ownership is looking at. If the ownership is looking for a guy that they want to build around and keep this get this franchise to a point to where they are a competitive franchise again, you look for a guy you think who can do that. But if they're foolish enough to think that they're, you know, just a player or two away from competing in the AFC North, which is one of the more rugged divisions in the league, you know, they're only going to be setting themselves up for a huge pitfall. They're going to find themselves right here 2 or 3 years later.
Yeah, and just looking at them, and again, they competed every single week, and they deserve credit. Just looking at the schedule, inside the division, they play Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, and Baltimore twice. If there's a tougher division, maybe it's the NFC East, but other than that, there really isn't a tougher division in football than that. Cincy twice, Baltimore twice, even though they did have their struggles, Pittsburgh twice. That is a very – that's six games right there, very tough opponents. But then you go look outside the division. They played Philadelphia, granted. Ended up with a terrible season, but a talented squad, and they lost to them 17-16 on opening day at a time when Philly was actually winning. I mean, you can analyze whether that was a good loss or not, but nonetheless, they played Philadelphia, who's a talented team. Then they played the Giants in Week 5. Again, a talented team. The record at the end of the day wasn't pretty. We can criticize the Giants all you want, but nonetheless, that's a pretty tough opponent nonetheless. They played the Colts, who's a playoff team. I actually think you can make a decent argument that Cleveland was a better team at 5-11 this year than what Indianapolis was, or what, I believe they're 11-5. So they played Indianapolis outside of conference. San Diego, again, I don't think they're a great team, but some talent there. They're not a Kansas City as far as a doormat goes as a competitor. They played Dallas in Week 11. Then they played Washington in Week 15, Denver in Week 16. I mean, those are some tough – that's a very tough schedule for a team that ended up winning five games. That's a lot tougher of a schedule than like an Indianapolis or even a Denver face. So you look at them and say they lost. They were 5-11. And I hate to give them too much credit for being competitive because I think that's important. But nonetheless, losing is losing. Being competitive but losing is still losing. But you look at that schedule, they had a very tough schedule. And you look at the Colts schedule, they played a few tough games outside of the division, but not very many. They played Chicago. They played Minnesota. They played Green Bay. Tough matchups there. They played New England, the Colts did. Detroit, if that's a tough game. They played Houston twice. That's in the division. But Cleveland had a much tougher schedule than a Colts team. And the Colts are being praised for everything they were able to do, and rightfully so. But the Browns played an extremely tough schedule, and they had a chance to be 7-9, 8-8. I understand really what I think this comes down to is new ownership wants to be owning there. And you don't really keep guys from the past when you're taking over fresh. And I think that's really what this comes down to. Ownership did not see Shurmur as a guy that they wanted. They didn't buy the team going, you know what, I'm so glad Shurmur's there. Whereas if you were buying, say, the Patriots, you say Bill Belichick's there, that's great. I'm so glad he's there. He may even be one of the reasons why I'm buying. Going in, Pat Shurmur, was not the case. So he's gone. I mean, if you're willing to get rid of Holmgren, How much of a chance does Pat Shurmur have of staying as well? But I think Shurmur's done a pretty good job there, and I agree with the players that, at the very least, I think they should have kept him just for one season, just to get things organized and get ready to see what they want to do. Unless, and maybe this is the case, unless Cleveland wants to go out there and get Andy Reid, or, again, we don't think Gruden's going, but if they want to go out and say, we want to bring in Gruden, or Cowher, or one of these big names, Kelly, if Chip Kelly is a guy they want, and I have no clue who Cleveland wants, but if they want to go out there and get a guy, Sean Payton, before he was signed again, if they want to go out and make a big move like that and kind of put their staple on the team now that they finally have full ownership of it, if that's what they want to do, I don't have a problem with them getting rid of Shurmur. Because if they think that's what they want to kind of start their voyage on in ownership, by all means, they should do that, and if that's what their call is. But if they go out and sign a guy who's never coached before, or bring in a GM who's never done it before, or a retread like a Tannenbaum or something, or A.J. Smith. I mean, if they want to make one of those kind of lateral moves, I think getting rid of Shurmur was a big mistake. But if they want to make a truly gigantic commitment to somebody who's seen as kind of a legend in the game, if that's what they want to do, then by all means, I don't see any problem with it. And I guess that's what we'll see going forward in Cleveland. Because as much as I Cleveland fans drive me nuts, I know some of them, and they're a wacky bunch. But nonetheless, football is better when Cleveland is competitive in it. And I'd like to see them. And I like some of the things they're doing. Trent Richardson's a good player. Whedon, I don't know if he's a franchise quarterback, but he's shown some pretty interesting things. I'd like to see if he could be a guy there. And they're not going to get him this year. There's no RG3 in this draft. So they're not going to get a fundamental Cam Newton type there for the future this year. So it'll be interesting to see what they do as far as the GM and the head coaching there. That's very interesting. But I would have liked to have seen Shermer get at least one more season there.
I would have loved to have seen that as well. But, again, ownership, did not buy that franchise with the mindset that, we're going to go forward with Pat Shermer. I think Shermer will get an opportunity to coach somewhere. I think he certainly has the potential to be a good coach. And I'm sure he'll get another opportunity somewhere down the road. But, again, the big question with this ownership right now is, what direction are they going to go? What do they want to do with this franchise? And like you said, this isn't going to be a draft where, this isn't a draft where you've got obvious franchise makers that are out there. So there's no RG3s. There are no Andrew Luck. There's not even a Julio Jones or a guy like that. So this is a slightly above average draft, but, there's no surefire guy that you can say is going to be able to turn a franchise around. I think that right now, with the Browns, I think that, who they pick is really going to determine their future. I really think that, if they go with the veteran guy, an Andy Reid or Lovie Smith, I think that, they're looking at a guy that they feel can take them to the playoffs, a little quicker than expected and get this team to jail. But if you're looking to go for a young coach, then, and you're looking to, you're basically saying, hey, we're going to be patient with this guy, let things develop, and as time goes by, within 2 or 3 years, we're going to have this team closer to where we want it to be than we originally started.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. Romeo Crennel and Casey, he's gone, but Scott Peel is going to be, looks like he's going to keep his job. I think this is interesting. Kansas City, from what I understand, they have the number one pick this year. It's a pick that I think needs to be traded, to be honest, because there isn't a superstar that you absolutely want to have it at number one pick. But I don't blame them for getting rid of Crennel. This was a disaster of a season. He has not been successful there. I think Crennel's a good guy. I think he's a good defensive mind. I think there's legitimate questions about whether he's a good head coach or not. And so I don't blame Kansas City for removing him from the job. And to be honest, after what happened there with Belcher, it wouldn't shock me or necessarily be a bad decision to get rid of everybody and start fresh. I would think that would have a pretty long-standing effect on those people, especially since literally they were there when it happened. But I find it interesting that they're keeping Pioli because, A, they need a coach for the future. There are some interesting names out there right now. And if they want a Chip Kelly or they want a Gruden or they want an Andy Reid, those kinds of decisions and moves have to be made now. You can't wait. So you can't give – you can't sit in indecision with Scott Pioli because you're going to lose and you're going to miss out on some opportunities that are out there right now that you just can't wait on. Now, maybe Gruden is a year away or even 2 years away because, again, we don't think he's going anywhere. But 2 or 3 years from now, maybe then all of a sudden Gruden could. But if you want Andy Reid, if you want Bill Cowher, if you want one of those guys, Chip Kelly especially, you've got to make that decision now. And if you're keeping Pioli, what that tells me is you're basically committing to Pioli not only for now – but for the extent of what you've got this new coach. Because usually a GM comes in and he wants to put his own guy in there. You don't want to have Pioli make this big commitment to Chip Kelly, and then all of a sudden he's gone the next season and the next GM doesn't even get to pick his coach. So it seems like for them to let – it seems like they should be getting rid of Pioli, or they should say, yes, this is a disaster, but Pioli's here for the long term. It almost seems like they should give Pioli an extension rather than just say he's safe for now. It seems like they're trying to – softly flow in between here. They don't want to commit and they don't want to cut bait. To me, that's where the mistake is being made here. It seems like they need to make one or the other because the number one pick, a new coach, with the coaches that are out there right now, you got to make a decision now. To me, they need to be a little bit more committed and a little bit more decisive here. To me, they're kind of hedging their bets. Do you think Pioli should be there or do you think he should be gone?
I think think that, you know, he should have been gone because, you know, he's part of the responsibility for, obviously, bringing in Romeo Crennel. And he has not had, you know, a stellar track record as far as his draft selections have gone as well, you know, and to consider that. I think that, you know, the Chiefs would have been better off just starting fresh by getting rid of both of them. Now, granted, you know, it was a trying season, obviously, for that team, both on and off the field. And I think that, you know, by getting rid of both of them, I think you're basically signaling not only to your fan base, but also to the franchise that, you know, we're going to start this fresh. We're going to start anew, and we're going to bring in new faces, new attitude, new opportunities. And I think that really would have helped, you know, the process of, you know, getting this team processed. Now you've got a head coach that's going to come in, and he's basically forced to be, you know, and basically forced into a marriage with the general manager. And those things normally don't work out well. You know, unless you bring in a guy that has a track record with dealing with Pioli, a guy like maybe a Josh McDaniels or someone like that, where, you know, he understands Pioli, knows, you know, his philosophy and everything like that, and so they went obviously jail. I just think that you look at Pioli and his track record. I just think that, you know, you should have been able to just simply let him go along with Crennel. I think it was kind of a half-hearted move by Kansas City to say, you know, we're going to make a change, but we're not going to really make a complete change. What if he has to go and it's got to be the head coach? It's the easier decision. And I guess with the Chiefs, I guess the Hunt family feels to a certain extent that they feel that Pioli has this franchise on the right track. And I don't know if that's necessarily the case.
No, I don't think you can say they're on the right track. Absolutely not. They seem to be a complete and total rudderless mess, to be fully honest. But there's some talent there, and I don't know. I'm just wondering because we're not as knowledgeable or it's not as easy. It's easy to say who's an up-and-coming coach and say if they could just add him. But can you really – is it easy to do that when it comes to GMs? You know, Dimitrov, who was in New England, who went to Atlanta, has done a great job there. But how many of those guys are there? Could they bring in a GM, like what Ron Wolf used to be in Green Bay, and all of a sudden totally turn that organization around and head them in the right direction? When Pioli was in New England, I think Kansas City signed him thinking he was that. Are there guys like that out there? So if they got rid of Pioli, like Trent Dilfer said, we talked about earlier, if you're going to get rid of this guy, who's the better guy you're going to bring in there? Is there a GM out there that could all of a sudden be this genius that turns everything around? If there is that guy out there, that's the question. Is there that guy? Because if that is the case, you get rid of Pioli and you bring him in. But is there that guy out there? And I don't know that. Do you know that? Is there someone out there?
And that's the question. You know, you don't know. You know, I mean, you know, it's kind of a case of, you know, it's the knowing hell versus the unknown heaven in this situation. You know, Pioli has not been that stellar, but at least you know his previous track record. And it gives you some level of hope that, you know, he's going to get things better. But if you get rid of him, you know, and you don't know who else, you know, you really don't have a good idea as to who is out there that you can look at and say, hey, you know, this guy is better than what we had. This guy's going to get us there a lot quicker. And, you know, and again, I just think that, you know, you have to go out and you have to, you know, take a risk. And I think that they would have been better served by taking that risk.
Yep, and Andy Reid gone in Philly. We've seen this coming. Two questions. Can a season go so wrong that a guy has to go? Because, again, Philadelphia was disappointing last year. They kind of put down a line and said 8-8, 9-7 isn't enough. If Philly isn't a true Super Bowl contender this year, Reid's gone. It seems like you shouldn't be making those kind of commitments. But nonetheless, the owner of the Eagles did that this year. And obviously they fell short, and he's got to feel pressure to stick to his word. And so Andy Reid's gone. But after 2 years of such disappointment in Philly, does Reid have to go? Or could they stick with Reid and change the personnel there? Because I'm just wondering, could have there been any way in which Reid could have stayed after this disaster of a season? And after that, why don't you talk a little bit about what Andy Reid is able to do in Philly, and then we'll talk about his future as well. But talk about what he did there, and was there any way that somehow they could have turned this thing around while keeping Andy Reid there?
I don't think that would have been in anyone's best interest to bring him back for another season. Like I said, you know, 14 years is an eternity in the National Football League now, and you're not going to get
coaches that have it, Tom Landry, Bud Grant, Chuck Knoll, Don Shula type of longevity. Those guys are, you know, this is, those things aren't going to happen anymore. I think that the team just stopped responding to him for the most part. And I think that, you know, his shtick had become stale. I know that he dealt with a lot of, you know, off-season tragedy, obviously, with the death of his son in training camp. And at the same time, you know, the injuries across the offensive line really hurt that team. You know, neither Vic nor Nick Foles really had time to develop an offense because, for the most part, you know, their offensive line was pretty much, you know, below average all season long because they're constantly filling holes. I just really feel that it was a clean break. And, you know, saw one of the press conferences. You know, I think both sides were happy. I think this is a case where this is a happy celebration. Reed knew it was time to go on. Lurie knew it was time to go on. And it just was a case where this team needed a new direction.
Yeah, I agree. And he was there a long time, and he did a lot of good things there. They didn't win a Super Bowl, but I mean, I don't think that should be the only factor. The fact is, there was a lot of success in Philadelphia, a lot of good years, and he had a great career there. That is an eternity. 14 years is an eternity. You really shouldn't be more than 7 or 8, to be honest. Bill Parcells never stayed for 15 years in one position, as far as I understand. So, yeah, I agree that he probably had to go, but I agree also that it's a happy, it should be celebrated rather than a kind of a sad or even angry breaking. It really does. It's just time to move on, and it's a good thing that he is. And going forward, normally I would think a guy should take a year off after this, especially since he's been there for so long. It doesn't seem like he should start right away. It seems like a year off makes sense. But you've got a lot of teams right now that need somebody, and they need a steadying force that can get this organization going in the right direction. And every single NFL season is an opportunity to win, an opportunity to be competitive. And it seems like nobody wants to wait that year. Nobody in baseball, teams know next year is not our year. But you know what? 2 or 3 years from now, that could be. So they plan that way. In the NFL, that's not what it is. Every single season is an opportunity to win. And so Andy Reid may have to come back somewhere. But my question is, should he take a year off? Or because of the urgency that exists in the NFL, there's a lot of opportunities out there. Should he take a job that's available now? And if so, which 2 or 3 do you see being really good fits to him where he shouldn't pass it up? Let's say Dallas whispered and said, you know what, we could really use Andy Reid. If we got, I would be willing to get rid of Garrett if Andy Reid would take the job. Would that be a fit? Or should he go to San Diego? I mean, what jobs do you think should Andy Reid jump right into? And if he's offered some of those other jobs, should he wait a year? Because next year there'll be just as many teams that are as desperate for him as anything else. It just, he could wait a year and have a great opportunity next year as well. And what are those opportunities? And what do you think he should do?
Well, he certainly has, you know, a lot of cards working in his favor. Obviously, he's a guy that can just sit back, you know, a year and just basically try to recharge himself. And by getting away with football, getting away from football, you know, he could obviously, you know, go to a television, you know, television show, you know, and if the network pregame shows would be more than happy to have a guy like him on there. But if he decides to come back, and I'm getting a strong feeling that he does, I think the one coaching situation to me, and I mentioned this earlier, I think Buffalo would be a very good fit for him because there's a lot of talent there, and I think that maybe they're a quarterback and a coach away. I think Arizona in a similar vein, you know, if you could try to right the ship with the quarterback, you know, is a good situation for Andy Reid. And I think those are really the two, you know, and it would be also intriguing that, you know, if Carolina does fire Rivera, and as of right now he is still their head coach, but if they were to fire him, it would be very interesting to see, considering Andy Reid's track record at quarterback and what he's done for quarterbacks for the most part, but he could do it again. Now, as much as, you know, everyone's telling you, I'd be curious to see what a Chip Kelly can do with a Cam Newton. I'd be just as curious to see what Andy Reid could do with this guy.
Let me just throw out a couple of ideas, because I want to look at the future as well. Looking into a situation like Atlanta, if they were to, again, be one and done in the playoffs, and then next year, again, they'd just be disappointing, a lot of young talent in Atlanta, but Mike Smith's done a fantastic job there. But if they have a disappointing playoffs this year and then another disappointing season next year or playoffs, Mike Smith could be gone there. I at some point, winning isn't enough. You got to win the ultimate title. And Mike Smith could be getting himself into a situation where he throws up his hands and says, what do you want me to do? I keep winning, but you don't win enough. Atlanta would be an interesting job for anybody. That's not going to happen after this season, but it could happen after next. The same thing in a Jets. I don't know if you want to jump into that pressure cooker that is the Jets, but nonetheless, New York is a place that a lot of people seem to want to go. Rex Ryan could very much be gone after the 2013 season. Look at Detroit. I don't know if Detroit's a place you really want to be there, but ownership's very good there. If Jim Schwartz has a bad season again in 2013, is that a job that he'd be interested in? Chicago right now. It's a great organization. People love football in Chicago. Could Reed go in there right now and be a situation there? If Houston collapses in the playoffs like they have now and then next year becomes another lost season, would Houston be a situation that he'd want to be in, again, not 2013, but the one after that? What do you think about a few of these spots? These are options going forward and future options rather than now, but what do you think of those possibilities? Or if he waits one more season, could he then go into Dallas? Maybe Jason Garrett gets one more year, and then he disappoints once again, then all of a sudden he goes in there. Are those better opportunities a year from now rather than the ones we're looking at right now? Like, again, Arizona, it looks good, but yet looks bad, depending on what happens with the quarterback situation. San Diego, do you want to go there? Kansas City, these don't look like great jobs, even though they look like opportunities. Are some of these opportunities that could come alive after next season, are those maybe more appealing?
You make a good point on some of those. Detroit would be a very intriguing one. And again, there's no official word saying that Jim Schwartz is safe in Detroit as of right now. Now, Detroit would be a very intriguing situation, only because of the fact, you look at the type of talent offensively that he would have. Andy Reid with both Matthew Stafford and Megatron, that would be a very winning proposition. I think it just boils down to what Andy wants to do. I think it boils down to whether or not, Andy wants to just sit back and, he'll be paid for 2013. Andy Reid has the choice to basically sit back and do nothing if he wants to for 2013. He doesn't need the money. He can sit back, there are opportunities that are there. There's also the opportunity of being a college coach because there are probably going to be opportunities out there next season with, several, top-tier jobs that could open up, on the collegiate level. Now, you make a good point, the fact that, maybe it might be in his best interest to sit back this year, recoup, recharge the batteries, and then lay back and see what happens around this time next year, who gets clipped. Because I think it's one of those things where, actors kind of makes the heart grow fonder to hell, and I think it's with the NFL coaches as well. If he sits back a year or two, he's going to be at the top of every list because people are going to remember the fact that, he brought the Eagles back to respectability. He coached in 5 NFC championship games. He got to a Super Bowl. For the most part, his teams were always competitive. 14 years and he only had 3 losing seasons. I think that, those are things that are going to work in his favor. Now, granted, there's going to be a lot of pressure for him to step up and take one of these coaching opportunities. But, I honestly feel that, if you were to sit back for the 2013 season, 2014 might have a hell of a lot better bounty than what he has right now.
Yeah, when you combine the lack of high-end talent in the draft this year and all the potential there is for jobs in after the 2013 season, it's risky because you don't know what's going to happen, of course, but I think that's interesting. Again, Detroit, I think he's going to be safe this year, but if they have another bad year, I don't think they're going to be able to hold off any longer. Atlanta, again, that may not ever make it, and if they win a couple playoff games, then that could all change. But again, Dallas, Jason Garrett either has to get off, he either has to crap or get off the seat, and I don't have a lot of confidence he's going to be able to get it done there. These are all interesting jobs. It'd be interesting to see if Andy Reid would be able to get the control that he would want in Dallas, but if he would be able to get it, that I would have to think would be an extremely appealing opportunity. And it looks like Garrett's probably going to be safe there. And it may even be better for Reed to take a year off and then go do something like that. It seems like some of the really better jobs, you have to have everything go right, but it seems like those are opportunities that could happen next year, the following year rather than this one. And taking a year off, I don't think is a bad thing. I mean, why jump right in? That's the way I figure it. But anyway, we've kind of gone through the heads of the coaches. We've gone through a little bit of what happened this week. Let's talk a little bit about, A, the games yesterday, and then get into the playoff talk. A huge win by Minnesota yesterday. A game that Green Bay had to win, too, by the way. We talk about how Minnesota, one of the most impressive things was that Indianapolis was able to beat Houston in a game that they didn't need to win. But Green Bay really did need to win, and they didn't. And they lost to a team that Ponder had a decent throwing game yesterday, but let's face it, he's not a great quarterback. Adrian Peterson is just a beast. And you don't usually see a guy run a team into field goal position. But that's what Adrian Peterson did. He ran his team into field goal position to win that game. To me, the MVP of the year, we'll talk about that more in following weeks as we're not kind of running out of time a little bit here. But we'll talk about that in much more detail. But to me, Adrian Peterson is far and away the MVP, and I don't even consider it close. Peyton Manning, the smell or the appeal of that story seems to be grabbing hold of a lot of media people. But to me, Adrian Peterson, and he confirmed it yesterday, he's the MVP without any question. I don't even see it really being close. Are the Vikings the story of the year as far as the biggest surprise that they were able to get where they were or where they are with what they had? I mean, Percy Harvin hasn't played a whole lot in the second half. Ponder has had some really bad games. He's just carried them. What did you see in yesterday's game? And then going forward, can Minnesota do it again, win another tough game in a must-win situation, and this time they have to do it in Green Bay? Can Minnesota win that playoff game next week?
I think they have a chance, but I don't really see it. I think that this is a Packers team that, is going to lick their wounds and know that, they struggled early, got back in the contest, but, just were not able to seal the deal in that game. It's going to be in Lambeau, and I think that, the crowd and, the team is going to be fired up, and I think that they're going to be more focused on shutting out Adrian Peterson and making Christian Ponder defeat them. You look at the surprise teams in the NFL this season, they're certainly up there, but I think that you look at the surprises, I think obviously people are going to look at the Indianapolis Colts and their success story, and I think probably Minnesota as well, right behind them, because again, you mentioned the fact that, Christian Ponder has not been effective for most of the season. Percy Harvin has been gone for most of the second half. This team has been really pretty much defense and Adrian Peterson, and yet their title look like they might falter. But, in the game yesterday just showed the will and the heart of the franchise and how they were able to just maximize, the abilities of Peterson and make, plays with Ponder on the other side of the ball. And I think Ponder's starting to come together.
Yeah, I like some of the things that Ponder does, and it's interesting. But, again, he had some really bad games, and you can't ignore that. Granted, their wide receivers aren't great with Percy Harvin not being there for a lot of the season, and it looks like he's probably gone after this year, so he's not even going to be there next season in all likelihood, it looks like, for personal reasons. But you can't ignore the fact that as much as Ponder showed potential sometimes, if you weren't, it sounds like we're almost being an apologist in defending him because he did have some really bad games. And then if you removed Adrian Peterson from his team, granted, one of the best running backs, if not definitely this year, but of all time possibly. I mean, he's on his way to putting together a claim like that. So you remove that from anybody, and of course a team would – so using that as an argument against Ponder, I guess, maybe doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But nonetheless, Ponder is not a guy that could carry a team, and he has had some bad games this year. But there's potential there that maybe he could at least be a solid game manager and make some plays. And so we'll see what happens going forward with that. But, yeah, I agree with you as far as winning this week. Anytime you've got Rodgers, I mean, you got to pick them anyway, right? I mean, they could go in as an underdog. They could have issues or injuries that make them an underdog going into a game. But at the end of the day, Rodgers can beat anybody. So yeah, I would have to definitely say Green Bay is the favorite. But we'll see what the conditions are. I mean, you gave the ball to Peterson, and he basically said, all right, where's the hole? And if I have to run 5 yards sideways before going forward, I'll do that. And he did it. I mean, that's what was one of the just insane things is the ball was supposed to run upfield in the middle. He just decides, okay, I got to run around the right, and then okay, and then he cuts back. He just did some Barry Sanders-like phenomenal types of things this year. And it's amazing what he was able to do with essentially nothing. He did a lot of it all on his own. So I would not necessarily I would not say the Vikings cannot win, but it's hard to point it out because he just does things that are completely impossible to kind of explain. But anyway, that's going to be a Saturday night 8 p.m. game. Watch and see what the conditions are. I mean, in Green Bay, you never know. If it's windy or snowy, maybe that has an impact as well. So we'll see what happens on Saturday night in Green Bay. The other Saturday game, the wild card game, Cincinnati versus Houston. Cincinnati played a meaningless game on Sunday. They go into Houston. Houston obviously reeling. What do you see in this one? Dalton to Green obviously has got to scare everybody. It looks like Ben Jarvis Green Ellis got a little bit injured on Sunday. I don't know his current status, but he's a kind of durable back that kind of gets 3 yards or 4 yards, and kind of he's not a big play guy. The way that Houston's playing, I don't think you would expect them to be able to beat anybody. But do you see what they could possibly do to win this one against Cincinnati? Because, again, Cincinnati had some stretches where they played pretty poorly, too. Now, they're playing as good as anyone right now, but that could turn on a dime pretty quickly. Is this going to be a great game, or do you think Houston is just – I mean, are they reeling so far out of control that this is pretty much one and done at Saturday at 4:30?
I think this is a team that's basically run out of gas. And I don't see any inspiration in that franchise. I don't see, you know, any – thing that suggests that there's going to be a spark that just lights them up come Saturday. And again, you know, everyone talks about how good the Bengals offense is, and without question, it can be very good times. But I think, you know, you overlook the fact that the defense that has, you know, played very well, especially over the last six games, when the stretch where they're, you know, maybe a player or two away from being, you know, going 6-0. You know, they were a point away from defeating Dallas a couple of weeks back. I just think that right now this Bengals team is more focused. I think this team is playing with more purpose, and it has a little more fire than the Texans right now. Over the last couple of weeks, I said that if there's a team in the AFC that could go in and shock one of the big, one of the top three teams, I thought the Bengals were capable of doing it. I think that's what's going to happen on Saturday.
And moving to the other game, starting on Sunday, 1 o'clock game, Indianapolis going up against Indianapolis. What is it there? Indianapolis against Baltimore. They've really been collapsing, Baltimore has. They did beat the Giants, what looks like an impressive win, but the way that the Giants have been playing, I'm not so sure it really was, but nonetheless, it looked like it was. People are giving them credit as if it was. Indianapolis looked great yesterday, but again, do we give them credit, or do we blame Houston on that? This one could be a really good one. Can Baltimore's defense get enough together to take advantage of the fact that Andrew Luck has really turned the ball over quite a bit this season? People seem to kind of overlook that. Granted, he throws the ball a lot, so of course turnovers are going to happen. But he's had a lot of turnovers. Baltimore good enough? Have they turned it around with that win over the Giants? Or is this a game that could go either way? Because if Baltimore's not playing well and their defense is still pretty mediocre to bad like they have been the last 5 or 6 weeks, this could be a pretty good game. How do you see this one going?
I think this is a game that the Ravens dominate. You know, Ray Lewis is going to be back, and I think that's going to really galvanize that franchise, you know, even just as a whole. I think that this is the time that you're going to see a steady stream of Ray Rice, and I think that their passing game is going to do just enough, you know, to take advantage of the Colts. You know, the Colts aren't a good defensive team, and I really feel that, you know, you look at this team and you're going to see a squad that, you know, granted they get to the playoffs, but you're going to see just how far along they really have to go. It's great that they got to the playoffs, but, you know, and this is a game that Indianapolis should really go win by at least a touchdown plus.
So you got Baltimore winning that one pretty easily. In talent, I would agree with you. But it would be easy for you to say, you know what, Baltimore stumbled and Indianapolis looked really good in the final week. I could see where you'd be excited about that, but you think Baltimore's just got too much talent for any? Because, again, I don't think Indianapolis is really that good of a team. I think their schedule was a little bit easy and things like that. I'm not overly impressed with Indianapolis, but nonetheless, I could see how you might be based on Sunday. But you see Baltimore getting it together. You think Ray Lewis being back will be a significant assistance there?
I think it will be a big boost for this club. And again, you have to remember that this is a playoff-tested team. You don't, you know, obviously you don't have any of those guys, you know, with the exception of Lewis, that were there for the Super Bowl run, you know, 12 plus years ago. But this is a team that, you know, a year ago came within a field goal of forcing overtime and on the AFC Championship game. And I think that this is a team that's going to just gel around Lewis. know, this is the team that, you know, yeah, they've had injuries, and yeah, they've limped into the postseason, but they're in there. And they've got a lot of tools that would suggest that they could win not only this game, but maybe a second-round game. Because, again, Ray Rice is pretty much fresh at this point. You know, Joe Flacco, if he plays within himself, is the kind of quarterback that can make plays. And you've got Torrey Smith. You've got Dennis Pitt at tight end. And you've also got, you know, Anquan Boldin. You've got three receivers that can get the ball downfield and make plays. All told, I just think that, you know, in Baltimore should have no problem defeating Indianapolis. And, you know, and depending on how well that game goes for them, you know, you have to wonder, you know, how they would match up against New England in the second round.
Yeah, it could be interesting, but I could see how Baltimore's talent is much better than Indianapolis, or at least it's much more reliably good. There's a lot of talent on this Indianapolis team, but defensively you got to wonder about them, and you wonder, will the turnovers come back to haunt Luck? But Reggie Wayne, Hilton, some nice players on that offense, and if they played up to what they could eventually be at some point in the next 2 or 3 years, you could see how they could overcome a much more talented Baltimore team. But I agree, it's a safer pick. I just wonder, because Baltimore, I mean, you don't change coordinators this late in the season very often. I have not been impressed with them at all for quite some time now. We'll see. We'll see what kind of Baltimore team comes out early in the game. But it could be ugly. I think that'll be an interesting game, like one of the more interesting ones. But we'll see. I guess we'll see what happens in the first quarter. We'll see what Pagano in the playoffs, you know, what kind of lift they – obviously they came out pretty much inspired in Week 17. We'll see if that carries over to the first playoff round. And it could. I mean, the playoffs, this team looked nowhere near like they could get here 12 months ago. So maybe they'll come in really inspired and with their new coach finally getting on the field. Maybe that will get them motivated. And motivation and effort's a big thing in the NFL. Maybe they come out and make this one a game. It definitely could happen. First quarter will be huge. We'll see what happens there. What I think is probably going to be the best game of the weekend, Seattle versus Washington. Sunday seems to be the young quarterbacks of the future kind of being highlighted with Andrew Luck at 1 o'clock and then Russell Wilson and RG3 at 4:30. Seattle versus Washington. In Washington, luckily for Washington, even though Seattle had the better record, or at least the same record, was 10-6 for Seattle or 11-5. Let's see here. Either way, the records are comparable, but Washington gets the home game because they won the NFC East. Again, Seattle has not played the toughest of schedules. Russell Wilson has been on a roll the last, 8 weeks now. I've been hesitant to give him the credit he probably deserves, and I think the schedule has something to do with that, or at least that's where I'm hanging my hat at the moment. But maybe I'm just stubborn like Rex Ryan and unwilling to relent and say that Russell Wilson's the real deal. But nonetheless, I'm willing to admit the last 6 weeks, he has definitely been the real deal. RG3, if he was healthy, this would be a phenomenal head-to-head matchup. He's still performed well the last few weeks. Obviously, they just keep winning, and they just beat Dallas to get in. Who's going to get it done here? Who's going to make the big mistake? Seattle's defense is phenomenal. They're going to have both of their corners back, if I'm not mistaken, because one won their appeal versus Pez, which is kind of a joke, in my opinion. But nonetheless, Sherman will not be suspended. And I believe the other corner will be back. Am I wrong there? Do you think the Seattle defense can shut down the Pistons?
I think that they can, and, you know, being in Seattle is a very difficult place to play. They're undefeated there this season, and I think that right now, man, this is a team that, you know, is really playing with a red-hot hand.